My brother keeps a human head in his closet. I hope I don't end up that way.
This thing, it's gonna follow you. Somebody gave it to me, and I passed it to you. It could look like someone you know, or it could be a stranger in a crowd. It can look like anyone.
Help! Santa Claus only brings presents to them that's been good all year. To the ones that ain't done nothing naughty. All the other ones. All the naughty ones. He punishes. You see Santa Claus tonight, you better run, boy. You better run for your life.
Bring me one of those chickens.
You got money to pay for it?
You paid for it.
No, but we're the king's men. So, you got money?
Not a penny. I'll still take that chicken.
You don't seem to understand the situation.
I understand that if any more words come pouring out your mouth, I'm going to have to eat every chicken in this room.
You lived your life for the king. You're going to die for some chickens.
Someone is.
Symbol is associated with a pagan deity named Bagul. He consumes the souls of human children. Early Christians believed that Bagul actually lived in the images themselves and that they were gateways into his realm.
I am seriously positive these were not here. How would we have, like, just made a campsite in between three piles of rocks just by coincidence? You don't think this is strange?
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I'm one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how are you?
I am well.
And in the state of New York?
Hi, this is Cletus. How you doing? Sorry, hi, this is Mike. How you doing, Phil?
Good, good. And in the state of Massachusetts?
Hey, everyone, this is Dave.
Abe, how are you?
I'm all right, thank you.
And a Connecticut American?
This is Christy. Hello.
All right. All right, so a couple of things. First off, Eric, you do another podcast with your buddy Dan. Why don't let folks know about that?
It's a general interest podcast called the Askancy Podcast. That's spelled A-S-K-A-N-C-I-T-Y. You can get us on Stitcher or at the iTunes store.
And Mike, you do a genre blog?
Yes, that's www.unnaturalselections.com.
And Chrissy, you have some sort of blog or something or do something?
Yep. I write short, dark fiction, and you can find out more about me at www.christypetersonschoonover.com. And don't worry if you butcher it. To this day so far, there still is only one of me. But yes, I do Google myself to just make sure there is still only one.
Oh, that's such a turn on.
And Abe, you do a blog.
Yep, it's called A Reeler Movie Reviewer. A Reeler spelled R-E-E-L-E-R, Movie Reviewer. You can find it by just putting in a basic search engine, or you can go visit Dark Discussion's main page and look on your right-hand side. It'll be linked to it right there you can access, as well as other goodies that might pique your interest.
That's right. So if you folks don't know how to spell Christy Peterson Schoonover, you can actually just go to www.darkdiscussions.com, and on the right of the front page is a link directly to her site, as well as the other sites as Abe mentioned. And then at the bottom of every page of darkdiscussions.com are links to the various Dark Discussions things, such as our email, darkdiscussions@aol.com, the Facebook group, Dark Discussions Podcast, Stitcher, where you can find us, iTunes, where you can find us, the RSS feed, and so forth. And you can also listen to any of the episodes of Dark Discussions podcast on the www.darkdiscussions.com website. Before we get into what we've been watching or things of that nature, any genre-related media, any news? Anybody want to bring up any news? Mike, I know you every so often find something that you want to mention. Anything this week or...
In terms of news?
Yep.
let's see. I don't know if this is good news or bad news, but apparently they're working on a Saw reboot. I don't think they're planning on doing a remake, but I think relaunching the franchise. They just released the trailer for the next installment of the Purge series, which we have talked about on the show before, but we've never actually done an episode on.
I think we did. Didn't we do? I can't remember. That's a good question. But anyway, continue. I'm sorry.
Okay, good. We've got so many episodes, we can't remember what the hell we've done anymore. Woohoo! and not really Dark Discussions related, but I'm very happy with it, is CBS has named Brian Fuller, who did the Hannibal series, and he did Pushing Daisies and Wonder Falls. He did most of the good parts of Heroes when that was on. He's been named as the showrunner for the new Star Trek series, which makes me really happy.
That's Dark Discussions related.
Well, it's not necessarily all that dark, unless it's a post-apocalyptic, zombie-infested Federation, which would be
dark
awesome.
Dark Discussions does science fiction fantasies.
Yeah, that's true. Okay.
Wonder Falls was kind of dark. I really loved that series.
Oh, Wonder Falls was. Dead Like Me certainly was. Yeah. Obviously, mm-hmm. Hannibal was.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes dark doesn't necessarily mean so horror or so science fiction that it's that black. You know what I mean? You can blur those lines. Sometimes it just means emotionally dark or very heavy. So
no, and my only concern is, what his marching orders are. How much creative freedom does he have? Because I'm someone who firmly believes that as much as I am grateful to Gene Roddenberry for starting the Star Trek franchise and the Star Trek universe, that he is in the end the thing that creatively strangled it and, kind of held it back. You could kind of make the same argument for George Lucas towards the end of Star Wars with the prequels. But is he going to be under the same, make it happy and optimistic, and there can't be any interpersonal strife at all ever between any of the characters on the show? Okay.
So this is going to be a television show, in other words.
It is a television series. Supposedly it's going to be used to force people to pay for CBS's on-demand service, because they're apparently going to just put it on their on-demand channel. And if you look at Netflix, one of their most consistent high-performing streams has been the old Star Trek series. So they know the Star Trek people are out there doing streaming.
Now, when you say old Star Trek series, do you mean the original 19, Captain Kirk ones or the Picard ones?
I think Netflix has them all, so I don't know. I don't know that I've ever read specifically which of them ones, whether it was Classic Trek, Next Gen, DS9, Voyager, or Enterprise, which are the ones that people are watching.
Right.
But there were certain limitations, like I said, that kind of forced them to get creative with how they set up the shows in order to have things like interpersonal conflict and stuff in order to keep with Roddenberry's very, what I always thought was a bit of a naive vision of the future. Hopeful, optimistic, but required people to stop acting like people.
Right. All right, that sounds interesting. So it'll be on CBS Demand, on-demand station, rather than...
Whatever
they'll call it, yeah. I actually did have a couple of things I did want to mention. The first thing is that during the Super Bowl sporting event in the U.S. of A., there was a new trailer for the Cloverfield movie that's coming out. That you can see on YouTube. Eric actually posted a link to it on the Dark Discussions podcast Facebook group, so folks can go over there and just link right over to it. And Chrissy, you actually commented on this. I posted it on the Dark Discussions podcast Facebook group. Big Hero 6 screenwriter Daniel Gerson dies at the age of 49.
Yeah.
That was a shame. Yeah.
Terrible. And that was sad because he did a lot of really nice stuff. His stories were always very tight. And again, like Mike mentioned, you don't know how much creative control these people actually have. I'm sure they had to change things because other people were making them. But his work was just always consistently solid, consistently good, and consistently emotionally moving. And I'm just really sorry to see, a really good writer just pass.
Yeah, and I remember I watched Big Hero 6 not long after seeing Horns, and I'm thinking, now that was a story that understood how to do a revenge sort of motive and, you know, eventual, you know, rise above those petty motives that I think Horns didn't earn. It tried to tell that story, and I think did it poorly.
Yep. Hero 6 was really really good. But then again, you know, a lot of Disney and Pixar and, you know, the people that write those things, I tend to most of the time be very pleased with the stories they're telling, but they are very sophisticated. I just saw Inside Out 2 weeks ago.
Oh, like, that was awesome.
Oh, my God. What an amazing film that was. I was laying there going, oh, my God, this is so sophisticated and intellectual, and yet it's emotional at the same time. And Pixar just consistently nails things for me. And Disney, well, now that Disney, that line between Disney and Pixar films is kind of blurred. Right. But they used to be very separate, you know, way back in the days of Chicken Little. And I love Chicken Little, don't get me wrong. It was a very emotional film. But Chicken Little didn't have the kind of intellectual depth. It had emotional depth, but not intellectual depth. And I think the combining of the two studios has really brought forth the best mix of both. And so I was very sorry to hear that this guy passed. It was just sad because I know he was instrumental in so much of that blending, as far as screenwriting. And like I said, it's just sad. So,
well, and I credit always goes to Pixar in my opinion, because they're one of the few studios now that still works on the story first model. I know that there was a lot of issues with The Good Dinosaur, but that's an exception.
Mm-hmm.
And that it was, you know, they will not, yeah, and they will drop a film if they can't feel they can get it to work. And in an age where, so many studios say, ooh, we have a title, we have a license, we have a date. Anybody want to write the story?
Yeah.
Right.
You know, we have a director, we have a cast, everything's done. Anyone feel like trying to make them fit? And so you do get something that feels like, a lot of times, you know, a little kid just dumped his toys out, saw it was there, and made a story to somehow incorporate a dinosaur, a robot, and Batman. And then,
yep,
Mike.
And
who created Pixar?
Who created Pixar? That was originally Steve Jobs.
Thank you. There you go. The man himself.
But also, too, what's interesting about Pixar is if you look at all their various story credits in terms of, like, who is in charge of the actual story, they tend to do really well, it seems to me, as a total outsider, but as somebody who just studies this stuff, matching the personalities of the screenwriters to the right story. And it's just like casting a show in theater, which I have a lot of experience with. You know, half of your battle is casting the right person to do the job. And Pixar actually pays attention to that. They don't sit there and go, oh, well, this screenwriter wrote this, this, and this, and made millions of dollars, so maybe he'd be good for this. They never seem to do that. They always seem to just pick someone who matches from within their company, and if they don't get someone within their company, then they go out and find somebody who will do it right. And that's always impressed me about them. They just, like you said, Mike, they really care about the type of story they're telling. And that's really important, because it all starts with story.
So. And they will push this, and they will push the release date back if the story is not ready.
Yes, absolutely. All right. They don't care.
Well, let's move on, because it was really more a news about the passing of a fine screenwriter rather than a history on Pixar, and whether it's a good thing. But, you know, we have to move on.
I do have a couple of items when you guys are done. So
okay, I just have two others. Stephen King, in the recent Rolling Stone article, has said that there appears to be a rebirth of a potential Dark Tower movie series, or at least a movie. Rumors are that Idris Elba could play the gunslinger and Matthew McConaughey could play the man in black. Again, this is all just rumors again, but he came out and did an interview to trying to promote this. And one other thing is, J.K. Rowling is releasing a brand new Harry Potter book, so she decided to go back to the bread and butter, and that's coming out in the summer. Part 8, where Harry Potter is going to be an adult, and it's going to be related to him and his children. So that was some of that news of interest. Eric, you were going to say something.
Just the whole Dark Tower thing. First of all, I wish they wouldn't try and adapt that particular story. It's too epic. They don't even have a chance of getting it right. The other thing is the cast of Idris Elba as the gunslinger. People are like, if you don't want him, it's just because you're racist. No. if you've actually read the story, there's actually a very significant relationship between the gunslinger and another character who is a black woman. And it's based on the fact that their races are different. Yes. There is a racial dynamic to that relationship, and it's actually a huge component of the freaking story. And that's why I don't want it to happen.
Well, let me ask this. Would that component still be able to work if they cast a white woman as the black woman?
Oh, that's a good
point. Not as well. In fact, I'd have to go reread some sections to see.
What if she was Polynesian?
No, definitely not. Because like some of it has to do with. I'll just say they end up. They don't always stay in the same time period. And some of the different time periods they end up in make race a very significant component.
I see. Interesting. Okay. All right. Well.
See, it seems to me that Idris Elba is where Jack Nicholson was in the late 80s and early 90s, where like every role that could possibly be, someone said, cast Jack Nicholson. We're doing Jane Eyre. How about Jack Nicholson? You know, just whatever it was. Because the difference being that at the time, Jack Nicholson was like a guaranteed box office hit,
right?
And Idris Elba isn't. They just—it's like, oh, he's a black man who can act that we like, and right. So.
And he's young, fairly young,
and he's not that young.
No, but he's middle aged.
He's middle aged.
Yeah.
So, but it's—I think there are people who've seen him, who like him, who really respect his talent, and they're trying to put him in everything. You know, he's the gunslinger. He's the next James Bond. I don't know. He's going to be the next Captain America. Who knows what they're going to cast him as next? You know, he's going to be in Pippi Longstocking. I have no clue. But, you know, it just seems like, you know, there are other actors. So I don't know.
He's a great actor. I'm not saying he can't act. I'm saying he's the wrong casting choice for this part.
I heard he's going to be the next Mary Poppins. Well, maybe not. So either way, that was interesting to see that, I guess for numerous dynamics from Stephen King himself trying to at least promote the possibility, never mind, the casting choices of, him and McConaughey. Oddly, I would think McConaughey would be good as the gunslinger, wouldn't he? But, because he's the new hip. You know, Jack Nicholson. I'll put him in every role. So,
although I think he'd be good as the Man in Black too.
Yeah, sure enough. So yeah, that's what I got. That's some of the news in the genre. I know, Chrissy, you said you had a couple of news related genre.
Yeah, Johnny Depp has apparently been cast for the remake of The Invisible Man.
Claude Rains.
I can't even, yeah. I just don't.
With Johnny Depp. I was Johnny Depped out about 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Wait until those stupid Kevin Smith where he plays the, right. They're coming out.
I just don't even want them to touch The Invisible Man. You know what? People go out and see the original. It's genius.
Oh, yeah.
We don't need to touch
not
this.
See the original as the case may be.
And read the book. Read the book.
And the book is really great.
Awesome. Yeah.
But also, in the original Invisible Man film, they didn't have half of the special effects capability that we have now.
And
they
awesome.
Did it so brilliantly and so effectively. Yeah. I can't imagine, what are they going to do? So I get to sit there and go, oh, look, he's vanishing by computer, by CGI. Like, it's
look,
just
I still
fucking pointless. I mean, half of the beauty of watching the original now is I can still sit there and go, oh, my God. How did they pull that off? There's a magic in it. Now it's just like, oh, they just did it. They just use a computer. Like,
well, it's like everything you think remade these days. So, you know, no surprise.
I know. But it's
Claude Rains is awesome.
And he's amazing. Yeah, he's got that darkness to him.
Yep.
That although I did appreciate Johnny Depp for a long time, I think now every time Johnny Depp gets in film, it's like, oh, I have to be insane and I have to be over the edge. And everybody forgets that Johnny Depp at one time was just a really quiet, dark actor who just did really well at being dark.
Yeah, yeah.
He doesn't have to be the Mad Murdock. You know what I mean? He can just be normal.
Let's not forget, though,
he also did Public Enemies and he also did Black Mass. It's just that those roles were films that didn't do well.
Those are
even if he,
right.
And so people kind of over, and they certainly weren't promoted the way, you know, Alice in Wonderland, for example, was. So yeah, people forget about them. You know, I give the guy some credit in that, you know, he does the movies he wants to do and he does them the way he wants. I don't think that, you know, things like Lone Ranger were a great idea. I enjoy his role in Tusk only because it pisses Phil off so much.
Oh, it's terrible. It's
but
so racist.
Yeah, it was just which makes it even better because it's against the French. But it was clearly the worst thing. Everybody pretty much agreed it was the worst thing in a Kevin
Smith film.
Quebec
French, though, that makes it even more sickening. How
whatever.
I will say this: Claude Rains, the Invisible Man movie was one of the first Universal horror films, and Claude Rains, that was the film that made him a superstar, and he is buried in Lake Winnipesaukee area of New Hampshire in Laconia. So if you need to find a grave, that's where he's located.
Ooh, cool. Field trip. Dark Discussions field trip.
And he was in The Wolfman, one of the best Universal horror films, in my opinion. But the most important thing is he was in Lawrence of Arabia. That's right.
That's true. I forgot about that.
Yep. But I'm with Abe. They are going to end up remaking everything. And when something is a pre-sold property, I don't know that they realize that the average, whatever, 20-year-old, whoever it is that's paying to go see films besides us, doesn't give a shit about The Invisible Man. They know the name, they recognize it, but I don't know that they have interest in going, oh, wow, an Invisible Man movie, and they got to go see it. And they basically did it with Hollow Man about 15 years ago, right? I mean
– yeah.
So – I think there's interest. There's stuff they can do with the character. My concern is I just don't like. And there's a friend of mine who, when this came out, was lamenting that everybody's got to turn everything into a shared universe like Marvel. And I pointed out that Universal did it first. However, you know, so while I'm glad to see them maybe trying to go that direction, I don't trust the people making the decisions to do it right.
Yeah, I'm sure the script will have nothing to do with what was great about the original movie and the book, which is alienation of you know, people with other people and stuff like that, and how it was in a rural section of England, and you know, of course, that's going to change because it's going to be in downtown Manhattan, and it's going to have nothing to do with people, alienization. It's going to be something else, and on and on.
When you cast Tom Cruise as the Wolfman and Johnny Depp as the Invisible Man and Idris Elba as the Bride of Frankenstein, I'm just wondering, you know, it's like they're trying too hard to put star actors in star roles, and these are not what the character should be. You know, it's like, did you see the Dracula reboot? Was it Dracula Untold?
I didn't see it, but it looked terrible. It was a
mediocre film, but it's just, you know, Dracula's not a hero character. Don't try to make him a hero character. The Invisible Man is supposed to go psychotic because of the drugs that he used to turn invisible. And I don't know that they're going to go that way with Johnny Depp. Obviously there's a certain tragedy to the Wolfman character. And this is not supposed to be the Justice League, but you know, they come together to fight whatever person they cast, you know, or maybe they do a CGI Marlon Brando as Dr. Moreau that they fight. Who knows? It's not the same thing.
And also, the original Universal films, another thing that made them great in a sense, at least when they first came out, was the fact that all the actors that were chosen for those roles were similar to what they did, you know, with the Star Wars franchise, where they get unknowns, and then after they are in the film, they become stars. So Claude Rains became a star because of Invisible Man. Boris Karloff became a star because of Frankenstein.
Vincent Price is the son of the Invisible Man. You know,
Carradine and Lon Chaney and Lon Chaney Jr. And who's the guy that played Dracula? Bela Lugosi. So all those guys, none of them were stars until they did the role. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, if it was me, I would say, don't do a $100 million budget. Do a $5 to $10 million budget on these films. They don't have to be huge. Don't make them action extravaganzas. You know, do them as period pieces. Go for mood. Go for atmosphere. There are plenty of directors out there who could do it. There are plenty of young or not so young actors who can fit these roles and get creative with them, play with them, you know, manipulate, and see what comes. And if the risk is so minimal, you know, that you'll make at $5 to $10 million, you'll make a profit just off the name. If you make a $100 million Invisible Man movie or Mummy movie or Wolfman movie, you could very well end up losing money on that.
Now, Mike, you mentioned, is that true that, like, we know that Tom Cruise is linked to the Mummy, and it appears that Johnny Depp is now linked to the Invisible Man, but you said Elvis Aldra, or how?
No, I was just joking. I said Bride of Frankenstein. He's not going to be the Bride of Frankenstein.
Gotcha. Yeah, but, well, there's many roles in that. There's a Dr. Frankenstein, too.
No, he's going to be the creature from the Black Lagoon.
And again, I'm assuming you're being facetious?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Yes, he is full of feces.
All right. Very well. So, that's an interesting thing about Johnny Depp linked to a new Invisible Man. I mean, I guess that's part of that Universal reboot that they're planning to do. And they're trying, like you said, Mike, to make the Universal today to be what Marvel and what DC is trying to do next. To be, which is have a franchise where all these movies are linked together, and they could just release a new one every year, similar to what they're going to do with Star Wars, another.
Right, but it really doesn't work well for horror. And I would strongly recommend to anybody who is interested in reading the comics is to go read, because I don't know, because the movie was god awful. Is go read Alan Moore's League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which has Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde and has the Invisible Man, among other Victorian-era literary characters, kind of together in the same story. Because he kind of gets the characters, and I think he uses them well.
But, Mike, you're sounding like the establishment. You should be more like Bernie Sanders, who would say, we can do it!
Stop.
We can do it! So the horror... We don't know if horror can't be in this a universe that could work. It could. We don't know until they try.
Bernie Sanders grew up in the age of Woodstock and the era of free love, so we all know what burn he's feeling.
Feel the burn, man. Feel the burn. But either way, I would disagree with that premise that horror can't work as a universe. Maybe it could. We don't know.
It can work in the universe, but I don't think you could do it in the way that they're trying to model it on, like Marvel.
Yeah.
Weird, convoluted, the old Universal films when they started doing the crossovers, convoluted way of trying to get these characters together. Like the Wolfman trying to find Dr. Frankenstein to cure him. And then they had House of Frankenstein and House of Dracula that threw them all together, which I haven't seen in a long time, but even then it always felt like a little bit of a stretch. You know, the characters have to come together in a way that's organic. And if they're all superheroes, well, they all band together to fight the same thing. If they're all monsters, what? They all band together to haunt the same person? I don't...
Well, yeah, no, I see your point. I can see why you would be somewhat skeptical. But I believe somehow, if the right people are involved, they could probably get something that would work. But
I say you have to have the right idea. Some of the characters, like the Frankenstein monster, can work, and certainly Lawrence Salva can work as sort of anti-heroes. But it's just not always an easy fit. And if this is something, by the way, you're interested in seeing, go watch Penny Dreadful, because they are very slowly and surely bringing in more and more of what, if they had the copyrights to them, would be the Universal monsters into the storyline.
Yep, yep.
Because Dracula is basically the villain in the first season, although they never name him, I don't think, as Dracula. For copyright reasons, I imagine. He's just referred to as the master.
Suave vampire?
Well, he's the master.
Gotcha.
You know, you have there's a cowboy character in like the very, I think might be the first scene in the first episode, who's like basically the star of the show, and there's a huge reveal about that character at the end of the second season. So I was saying, so watch Penny Dreadful. That's if you want something that does a good job of blending these characters together in a somewhat organic manner, that's probably your best bet.
But also it does have the fabulous and beautiful actress, French actress, Ava Green as well. All right, so that's good. Yeah, and that is a recommendation. I haven't watched much of the show. I do have season one of Penny Dreadful on Blu-ray, but I believe there's three seasons now, and it's a Showtime series, and it's supposed to be really good. Chrissy, you had some more news, I heard.
Oh, I actually did. A release date for the UK film High Rise has been announced. Are you guys familiar with that? Or
nope.
Okay. It's been on my radar. No. Radar. Yeah, whatever. It's been.
Did you say Roro or Roro?
No, I said it's been on my radar. I've been thinking about Indiana Jones. I'm an idiot. It's been on my radar for quite a while, actually. The reviews are mixed. It ran the festival circuit. It's been released already overseas.
But is it like a horror thriller? What is it?
Well, I'm going to explain that. It stars Tom Hiddleston, and it's basically about an apartment building. This guy moves in, and everything goes to shit. It is based on the book by J.G. Ballard.
Oh, yeah.
His name was always so tough for me to say. Yeah, but you know who he is, right?
Oh, yeah.
The novel High Rise of the same name came out in the 1970s. I will admit that I never read it, but my dad loved to read all those 1970s thrillers. And I do remember seeing it on his shelf, and it was one of the very few, along with something else, that he wouldn't let me read. I pretty much had access to everything, even when I was 12. He's like, whatever, I don't care. Just show it to me first and don't tell your mother. So that one he actually did let me read. But some listeners might know Ballard from the book he wrote called Empire of the Sun. And that was really the most mainstream of his works. It was about World War II and the little boy who was abandoned after the London bombings. It was also made into a Spielberg movie, in the late 80s. And it had a beautiful score. And actually, that's probably why my first marriage was doomed, because I walked down the aisle to some of the music from that film for my first marriage. But anyway, Ballard wrote a lot of stuff that was kind of out there. And if you're not really familiar of his work, some of you guys might remember the David Cronenberg film Crash that came out in the mid-1990s. Yeah. The one about the getting sexual gratification from
accidents and
from car accidents. Yeah. That was based on a chapter of another book of his. And that chapter became a novel in the 70s called Crash, of the same name. So anyway, that's probably what this film High Rise is going to be like. It's going to be similar in tone to probably Crash, I'm thinking. Because, you know, Ballard at that time that he was writing that stuff was kind of all in the same vein. You know, Phil, how as writers we cycle? We kind of go in the same kind of mode or the same kind of mood or the same kind of tone.
Yeah.
We're addressing the camp. And that was kind of the mood he was in. He was very much about connecting mechanics to humanity. And so High Rise kind of came out of that whole time frame, whereas Empire of the Sun, which was very different, as you know, came out of a different time in his life. So it's a release date has been announced. Finally, it's been forever. It's going to be on demand April 28th, and it's supposed to have a limited theatrical release in the U.S. I want to say it's the middle of May. But April 28th, it should be available on demand.
Very good. And yeah, that sounds like a art house thriller or art house horror thriller type film. So, because it is, you know, the way you explained it. But having the Hiddleston, which is a pretty big name right now, will give it a pretty high profile on VOD, I bet.
Well, and a lot of his written work, his short stories, his fantastic fiction has been, I don't know if he's considered like a contemporary of William Burroughs, but it's like in that same vein. Yeah, he's sort of considered in that same,
yeah, I would say Burroughs was probably before him because obviously Burroughs was the Kerouac sort of era, thing, you know?
Like a little on the edge of Bizarro.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
So like Naked Lunch and that sort of stuff, he was almost going there, but he was, in terms of his writing, he was a little more rooted in reality than Burroughs was.
Hunter S. Thompson, maybe.
Yeah. Actually, I would more closely compare him to that, but not as raw, if that makes sense.
Sure.
So, I mean, I'm talking about in terms of his writing, not any of the films or anything that that have been based on his work. But I think it might actually be something, depending on when I watch it, if it's, it might be something we might want to talk about, because it's obviously going to deal with, the film is set in London in the 1970s. So you're talking a, quote, sophisticated high rise that would have been about like the Towering Inferno kind of era. So it's going to be interesting to see what they do with the outdated technology and how they place that and all of that. I'm just very interested to see what they do with it.
Right. Yeah. Well, when it comes, gets closer in April, that could possibly most certainly be something of interest for the Dark Discussions podcast to possibly do an episode on, especially if there's a lot to talk about and if it's any good. So.
Yeah. Oh, and Eric, are you there? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I finally read your Best of 15 article today, and I really enjoyed it, and I put a lot of things on my list. So I just want to say thanks for putting that all in writing, and it was a great job.
Oh, you're welcome.
Yay.
Thank you.
Speaking
of
that,
I had
Eric,
it on my list to read, and I was just like, okay, I got to read it. And then finally I was like, yay, I have 5 minutes. I'm going to go over here with my cup of coffee and read.
And speaking of this article, Eric, where can folks find it?
They can find it on darkdiscussions.com. There's an articles link right at the top of the page. It'll take you to it. I think it's the latest thing posted up there, but there's a few others that have been written by other folks over time. And it's basically just my look back at genre films in 2015. I talked about some of it on our episode that we looked back at 2015. But that was really more group-centric rather than everybody's individual thoughts. And so you get my individual thoughts there in the article.
Yeah, that's right. It's a good article too, as Chrissy just stated.
And, thank you. Although I've noticed since it went up that there are a bunch of typos and I really, really, really want to fix them. Can I fix them, Phil? Can I please fix my typos?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Please let him fix his typos.
Yeah.
I was completely busy when I was writing that and wrote it as quickly as possible to get it out the door so you'd have it in a reasonable
amount. I really enjoyed it anyway. So that just tells you if I enjoyed it, that means I really didn't notice that many. I think I saw maybe one. So,
okay, I noticed at least like half a dozen, so I want to fix
them. Yeah, there's probably more, like you said, but I was just enjoying reading it, so I wasn't paying attention.
Yay.
So that's a good thing. It's a good thing.
And welcome to another edition of Terror Tantrums. If you're new to the segment, my name is Patrick Lacey. I am a horror novelist and longtime listener of Dark Discussions podcast. And this is a segment where I discuss a lesser known or obscure horror film that I'm seeing for the first time and hopefully give an unbiased review. This week I've chosen a film called The Nesting, which is a 1981 movie directed by Armand Weston. And this is another release through Blue Underground, and like I said on past episodes, like Scream Factory, they're one of my favorite companies releasing some of these older and obscure horror films, usually with good special features, although we'll get to that in a little bit, but this one doesn't have too many to speak of. But basically, this is a haunted house film, and I think IMDb has a really, really concise summary, so I'm just going to read that. It says, a writer suffering from agoraphobia rents an isolated house so she can concentrate on her writing. She doesn't know that the house is a former brothel and is inhabited by the ghosts of dead prostitutes. So that's pretty much the main conceit of the film. Not too much new going on. I mean, if you've seen any sort of haunted house, you've seen this. But the way in which they go about exploring the haunting, I think, is interesting and worth discussing. One thing of note is it's probably one of the tightest opening scenes I've ever seen. They get to – I mean, this isn't really a plot spoiler, but like in the summary, it shows the outside of the brothel, and then it just shows lights going on and then gunshots and they're screaming. And it might be a 10-second-long segment before the title rolls, and then we're at present day. So it's just literally super effective. We don't see who the murderers are or anything like that. I've just never seen, I don't think, an opening scene that is that concise. So props to them for that. Another thing I want to talk about are the dream sequences. I had mentioned before on a prior episode of Deadly Friend, actually, which has some similar dream sequences, that I'm a sucker for them. I just think it's cool. You can do stuff that you wouldn't normally do and kind of make the scene trippy. And this one certainly excels at that. There's basically, I think, three or four where the main character dreams about the prostitutes who at one point lived in the brothel and then were subsequently murdered. It has a distinct Roman Polanski flavor. It kind of reminded me of Rosemary's Baby and also of The Tenant, where there's kind of these leering faces staring over her, laughing, and the camera will get really, really close, and their expressions are just haunting. I don't know what it is, but it kind of made the movie for me. So that was interesting. Of course, the main character having mental illness, I think, usually adds a pretty interesting layer. And it works with this film, too, because it's almost as we, the viewers, are going insane along with her. So at the beginning, when she goes to the haunted house and starts having suspicions that it's haunted, you could kind of chalk it up to her being mentally ill and having agoraphobia. But as the movie goes on, it's apparent that it's not just her condition, and some pretty spooky things are going on. So in terms of that and the pacing, I think that was well done. My only real complaint about this film, I mean, aside from, like I said, it doesn't really touch any new ground. So if you've seen a lot of horror movies, I mean, a lot of haunted house movies, I should say, this isn't really going to change your mind or add anything new to the mix. But in terms of the film itself, there's one scene where, and I don't think this is a plot spoiler, but she's being pursued by a man who may or may not have had something to do with the massacre at the brothel. That's all I'll say. But the scene goes on for so long, and it takes place outside of the house itself. So it kind of took me out of it, because by the time this scene is resolved and she gets back to the haunted house, I had almost forgotten it was a haunted house film to begin with. So I don't know if that's a small gripe, but that really just kind of took me out of it. And then another thing I'll say, and this is actually a plus that I should have mentioned earlier, is there's a flashback sequence while we're being told something about the brothel massacre by a character who was involved with it. And I won't say what it is, because it is the main plot spoiler. But the revelation was really interesting. I didn't see it coming. It involves several of the characters who are in the film. It blindsided me. I did not see it coming. So I thought that was pretty interesting. But overall, it's a decent film. I wouldn't say go out of your way and spend a ton of money on it, but if you can find it cheap online like I did, I think I paid $10 or $12 for it, and you are a fan of what Blue Underground has put out, but also haunted house films in general, I would say it's probably worth a shot. Like I said earlier, it's a good transfer. It sounds good, but the special features are kind of lacking. I think there's 10 deleted scenes, which is pretty cool, but I also read that there's a director's cut that exists somewhere, and most of these scenes are in that. So I'd be interested to know why they didn't either just give the director's cut as the main feature, or at least have that as an option in the special features. I don't know if there's some sort of like rights issue, but I would think not if all those deleted scenes are accounted for in the special features. But other than that, there's really nothing else to speak of. There's a theatrical trailer and some stills from the movie, but I kind of hoped for something else, because I'd really like to at least get a commentary with the director. If he's still alive, I shouldn't say. I don't really know. That would be a great reason if they didn't have it. But like I said, there's a distinctive flair with this film that I think it would be really interesting to learn more about. But overall, I would recommend it. I wouldn't say it's the best movie I've ever seen, but it does some pretty interesting stuff that I haven't seen in certain horror movies, at least especially with the revelation that comes at the end. So if any of that sounds interesting, I'd say check it out. And also you should check out most of Blue Underground's other stuff, because they've been killing it in the last few years. That's it for this segment. If you have any other films that you want to suggest, hit the guys up on the Facebook group or send them an email. And if I haven't seen the film, I will add it to my list. Until next time, thanks.
So let's get into some of the things we've seen recently, and we'll go around the table. Why don't you start, Abe? Have you seen any films or video games or anything that you – anime or whatever that you wanted to mention that folks that would listen to this podcast would be interested in?
Well, I do have a bit of video game news. They recently just released the cinematic opening trailer for Dark Souls 3, basically the opening scene to the game. It's kind of a spoilerific, unfortunately, though. But if you really are have a hankering to see what this game is going to be have in store for you, it's kind of worth checking out. I kind of just want to take a peek at it because I got a bit of a way ahead of me before it comes out. And for those who are not familiar with what this game is, it is the third and, according to the game's director, the final installment of a long of a trilogy of dark fantasy games. Basically, hardcore dungeon crawlers. And it has a strong following, and it'll be released for PC, PlayStation 4, and Xbox One. Its Japanese release date will be March 24th, and for us in the States, it will be April 12th this year. It's definitely a big deal for the community, mainly because now we get to piece together some theories and some lore, so it's kind of worth checking out. But if you want to go in blind, then kind of hold off.
Now, when you say hold off, you mean play the older games?
No, not hold off, but basically don't jump into watching any trailers.
And don't watch the trailers. Gotcha. Yeah.
So you can just have some complete surprise when you go into the game.
Now, since it's being released in Japan first, I assume it's a Japanese video game company. Which one is it?
From software developers.
Okay, I'm not familiar with them, but obviously they have to be somewhat big if they're related, linked to this series. So I assume you're gonna pick it up.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
All right, very good. Anything else, Abe?
Not on my end.
All right, Eric, what about yourself?
Well, I did rewatch Bone Tomahawk with my friend Dan because I just wanted to watch his reaction to some of the events in that movie. He enjoyed it. I knew he would because he's a Western guy. He likes Westerns anyway. So, but Dan's usually the guy who says, "I don't understand why people think that's so bad. That's not that violent." Blah blah blah. But when it got to the scene in that movie, he turned to me afterwards and went, "That was kind of rough."
Indeed.
If I can interject for one second, Eric, since you're talking about it, the listeners, a couple of listeners, and I can't remember who they are now, I apologize, had asked if we were going to do an episode. I would love to do an episode on that.
Okay. Have you seen the film?
Is anybody else game?
Have you seen the film, Chrissy?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, okay.
It was one of my special things that I had. Yes.
I mean, I'll show up and listen to Christy talk about it. It seemed pretty
I mean, if you guys don't think it's a good idea, that's fine. It was just I know people
have noticed a bunch of symbolism and shit that went way over my head. I'll listen to you talk about it.
Well, it might be fun to talk about it within the context of other Westerns and stuff. It's got potential, I think. But we'll think about it.
All right.
Yep. Anything else, Eric?
I also watched a movie called Southbound. It's an anthology film done by the VHS guys. I enjoyed it, although it was a little, how do I say this? It was extremely ambiguous. None of the segments really had any resolution. So that bugged me a little bit. I mean, usually by the end of an anthology, there's at least something that gives you some kind of ending, and there really wasn't here, so that bugged me a little. but most of the segments were interesting in and of themselves. Possibly my favorite line delivery of the year so far, which is that there's a scene where somebody is trying to care for somebody who's seriously injured, and they're talking to 911 on the phone, and the 911 operator asks him, "How's her breathing?" And his answer is, "It's upsetting." So that cracked me up. So I like Southbound overall.
Now, Eric, yeah, I saw it too. A couple things I wanted to mention about it, a couple mentions in your opinion. The first thing is that Maria Olson, who we interviewed for the Starry Eyes episode,
yes,
the actress, she's actually has a part in this film.
She does. I recognized her immediately when I saw her in the phone booth.
Yep, that's right. Yep. So that was kind of cool to see her there. My personal opinion is I think it was everything you said about it is 100%. I'm with you 100% with everything you said. And if I had to compare it with the VHS films, I would say it's weaker than those films, but that's just my opinion. And it's not because they changed the style, because the VHS films are found footage. This is not. I just think what you said, Eric, which is the resolution of the stories. And to be honest, I didn't think they were as scary as some of the ones that were in VHS.
Right.
Or as creative, because, you know, in VHS, you have, being found footage, you have to be a little more creative to try to figure out how to get it to work. And as a result, I think it was a weaker entry to these producers' films, but still a pretty good film.
There was an opening and a closing segment that kind of tied together, and I think that would have been really strong if they had put a bow on it, but they didn't put a bow on it, so you're just left with, meh? All right.
Yeah. Do you think that they were implying that the whole place is a hell or afterlife or?
I don't know, man.
Yeah, I don't either. I was still quite confused as well. But I know it's getting good reviews and a lot of folks are liking it. So,
I mean, I enjoyed the experience watching the movie. I'm recommending it. I'm just saying, go in expecting ambiguity.
Yeah, and it is an anthology, so obviously. You know, there's better parts than other parts, and so it's always has an odd field because just for that fact. Anything else, Eric?
That's it for me.
All right, very well. I'll go next. I actually saw that film too, and I concur with what everything that Eric said. I did see the fourth episode of Colony, the USA Network science fiction post alien invasion series, and still enjoying it, and will continue watching it. It's on every Thursday night, so I'll watch tonight's episode, because we're recording on a Thursday. I'll watch that on demand tomorrow or over the weekend. I did mention this last week, Chrissy, when we recorded, that I saw Frozen, the Disney film, for the first time.
God.
And that was great. Great film.
Let it go, Phil.
It's awesome.
Oh, it's the best film ever.
Let it go.
I did see another Pixar Disney film, Brave. That's good. Chrissy, you've seen that one?
I did. I'll give my brief 5-second
really brief
reaction to Brave. Very brief.
Yep.
I did not like it only because I got to the end. And, you know, of course, it's all about the mother-daughter relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And the mother supposedly died, and I was not crying. So that tells me they kind of messed up in the story somewhere there. Yeah, because any kind of mother and daughter story always makes me bawl. And if they do a mother and daughter film and I'm not crying,
they didn't
do it right. Sorry.
Very good. Yep.
Oh, I'd like to see a mother-daughter film.
Yeah.
But I thought it was pretty good film. But I could see, I mean, it did win the Academy Award for Best Animated Film, and this is the film right before Frozen.
Oh, it was beautifully done and all that. There was a hole somewhere, because otherwise it would have been bawling.
And if you compare it to Frozen, obviously it's most certainly much weaker, just for the fact that Frozen was, you know, is a classic. And Brave, you could argue, is a classic because it did win the Academy Award, but it's definitely a weaker film. I did see two other films of note, non-related to genre, but important. I saw the Steve Jobs film. I bought it on iTunes, and it was completely different than what I was expecting.
Is it really good, Phil? Because I've been looking forward to seeing
it. Was it about Bill Gates?
No. It was about Steve Jobs, and it was...
And it wasn't completely different from what you were expecting.
It was... I texted Eric, and I told him that I thought it was fair. Doesn't really portray Jobs as a dink that some folks were thinking the film was going to do. It just showed him as a flawed human being like anybody else that was still a great and legend in all ways. And but it was an interesting way they did the film, because what it is, it's almost like vignettes where it's before he introduces the Mac, and then before he introduces the Next, and then before he introduces the iMac.
Okay.
And so it really it's a film where they just have him in the back behind the stage for 35 minutes or 40 minutes each segment or each vignette, and what happens then. And so it's not really a biopic. So it's completely different than what you would expect from a biopic. So it is curious. I thought it was a very good film. And the timid feeling I had going in to watch the film was most certainly unfounded after I walked out, or figuratively walked out, because I watched it in my own living room. It wasn't the burn job that I thought it was going to be. No pun intended.
Well, I was when we were texting, I was telling Phil that I really wasn't all that interested in this film because I know so much about Steve Jobs already. So it really wasn't on my top of my list as far as viewing material goes. But Steve Jobs is a fascinating figure. Whether you're pro Apple or anti Apple, he was just an extraordinarily charismatic man and a hell of a public speaker. And even if you don't go watch this movie, you should just go find a couple of his keynotes on YouTube or something, because the man could speak like nobody else when he got up on stage. In fact, they made up a term for it. They called it his reality distortion field. Because he just made everything he was introducing seem so awesome. Watch this movie, go watch him speak a couple times. It's worth your time.
And you know who else was an awesome public speaker? Adolf Hitler.
I knew you were going to.
Yes,
I knew you were going to say that. That's a terrible thing to try to compare him to Adolf Hitler. Like that's just quite rude. Quite rude.
That's our mic.
I'm just saying, good
going public speakers. Any industry to disparage Apple.
And so, yep, exactly.
I'm not disparaging Apple.
About Apple. The Kate Winslet character, she plays someone that's real, a woman named Hoffman, and I've read about her on Facebook, not Facebook, I'm sorry, just the internet in general. But I believe that her character, I thought, was going to be overdone, because if you see all the documentaries with Steve Jobs, the woman Hoffman is not that important in any of the documentaries about Steve Jobs. She's important, but not that important compared to other folks. But since it's a vignette type of film, it wasn't a forced thing. Where, in other words, they were trying to put a female lead into the film, but because it's a vignette, where she happens to be in the room for 45 minutes with them in each of the scenes, it works. And even if her character in real life, Hoffman in real life, isn't as important as, say, numerous other people that Steve Jobs worked with at Apple. So that also was a thing I was worried about. But because, again, since it's vignettes, it worked. Let's see. The other film I saw is Spotlight, which is the film that's up for Academy Award for Best Picture and whatnot, about the Boston Catholic, Roman Catholic Church.
Oh, God. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And that film that was a fantastic film. If you like the film, The Thrower, All the President's Men, which starred Dustin Hoffman and Robert Redford, you'll like this film, Spotlight. It's in the same vein. So it was good. It was really good. There's some damn good lines in it, too. There's a scene between Gregorian, I think his name is. He was a lawyer, one of the lawyers that broke the case. And Refendez, I think the guy's name is, who's a Boston Globe reporter. They're eating lunch, talking about, you know, how they're going to try to break the story or whatever. And the lawyer, Gregorian, goes, we have no chance. And you go, and Refendez, or whatever his name is, he says, why do you say that? He goes, and the lawyer goes, because I'm Armenian. This city is owned by the Irish and Italians. Do you think we're going to get anywhere? I've got nowhere. It's all, if you're not part of the community, forget about it. And he goes, you should know because you're Italian, aren't you? And he goes, no, I'm Portuguese. And then, and then the lawyer goes, see, you know what I'm talking about. And to be honest, so, at that so time.
Leave it to you, Phil, for your favorite part of the movie to be where everyone talks about their nationality.
Oh, dude. And that's because I grew up in Greater Boston, my friend. It's very important. Believe me. Yeah, I mean, if you grew up in this area, it's crazy. So, but that was an interesting thing, and it kind of showed a good point of how Boston, unfortunately, has worked in the past. But it's a great film, and I recommend. So that's pretty much my stuff. And that was it. I think there was one genre film besides Southbound I saw, but I can't remember. But either way, Mike, what about yourself?
The only thing of genre interest that I have watched of late is that we went to see Pride and Prejudice and Zombies.
Oh, is that any good?
Is it any good? Yes.
Okay.
Is it really good?
World War Z.
I really liked World War Z. This was there. It was okay. But understand, as a heterosexual white male, it is within my purview not to give a shit about Pride and Prejudice, so I don't really know the story going in.
Neither do
I'm
I.
Sorry, I'm a female, and I hate Pride and Prejudice. I hated it when I was 16, and I never even read the fucking book, because my dad said, just read the Cliff Notes, you're better off.
Yeah, and Mike, and based off the trailer, Mike, I could see how they knew that males wouldn't be interested in it. So the trailer obviously shows, the woman putting guns and knives.
Well, I could certainly see a certain percentage, and I don't think it's an insubstantial percentage, of horror female fans like this film because the girls get to both kick ass and dress up in fancy costumes.
Yep.
So I the only thing I have is, again, I don't know Pride and Prejudice well. Or much at all. And so any in-jokes that might have been there went over my head or under my head or somewhere. And it's not a jokey film. There are a few laughable moments in it, intentionally, I should add. But it's not like like a parody. It's not an Airplane or Young Frankenstein-type parody. You know, so it plays everything kind of straight, which feels weird for a film called Pride and Prejudice and Zombies. Matt Smith is fun playing the deacon, I think, or preacher, pastor character, but he's a largely comedic role and doesn't quite seem like he's in the same movie as everybody else. Charles Dance plays the father, and Lena Headey plays, I can't remember the character's name, but she plays the Countess plays an important character in the show, in the film. So you got two Game of Thrones stars in it. I think overall it's decent. It's not a film I fell in love with. I think it just felt weird tonally, and the story structure didn't quite gel the way I think maybe they would have liked it. And there's at least one major subplot that seemed to go absolutely nowhere, dealing with the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. Yeah, and, because they make a big deal out of it at a couple of points in the film, and it has no resolution at all. If you're looking to see a horror movie in the theaters, there's not a lot to choose from. I would go to see Mama first, not Mama, The Boy first.
I was about to say, what year is this?
I would go see The Boy first, and then I would see Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, and then I'd go see The Boy again, And then maybe if it's still in theaters, go see The Forest. But you know, it's, but by that
as,
point,
as long as you don't sit down and spend money on VOD to watch the Martyrs remake.
But but at the same time, by the time you've gone through that, you probably would have The Witch out or The Vivitch out in theaters next weekend. So
The Vivitch!
Is that next weekend?
Yes.
Hell yeah.
All right. That's interesting. So it's a film that passed the time is what you're trying to say.
It passed the time. It had some good zombie moments in it. It had an interesting take on zombie mythology. You know, there are some decent things in it, some nice ideas, but I don't think it quite came together the way they probably would have liked, or at least it didn't for me. I don't know what anyone else thought. So, and Pam seemed to be about in the same place.
Hmm. Okay. All right. Fair enough. Would it be a top 10 horror film for the year?
Oh, God, I hope not.
That's all I needed to know. That's what I was looking for. All right, that's interesting. Anything else, Mike?
Searching my memory banks. Hang on. Not that I can think of.
Okay, very well. I guess that's pretty much it for what we've been watching in news. So I guess we can get into our next segment, which is our topic for tonight. So, Eric, why don't everybody know what we're going to discuss?
Tonight, we are talking about a movie called Landmine Goes Click.
Таня, нет.
Точно нет.
Точно нет.
I lied about the pitch.
No, you don't.
I want to know why. I want to know personal
address.
Now we're all crazy.
I will punish you for that.
Landmine Goes Click is a, to my knowledge, a Georgian film, meaning it's actually produced by the country of Georgia, because the director, screenwriter, is from Georgia, and this is really his film. And my guess, based off of what I've read, it is actually a Georgian film, even though it is basically mostly an English language film.
They filmed it in Georgia.
Yes, they sure did, yeah. And they had Georgian actors and actresses a lot in it, too. You going to say something, Chrissy?
Yeah, I just have a question about that. When I rented it on Amazon, it said that you know where they normally have the publishing company for books, or they have the production company for films?
Yeah.
It said Create Space on the rental thing. I found that interesting. I didn't know if you guys knew anything about that, so I just made a note about it because I wanted to ask.
Yeah.
Does Create Space have a way to just upload your films directly? It just seems kind of odd to me. Not in a bad way. I was just like, oh, I've never seen that before, so I just wanted to ask. Maybe you guys had seen it.
No. That is curious, too. I don't know. For folks who don't know, Create Space is the publishing company for Amazon, where folks can publish their own work, or small press or whatever. And a lot of times, if you don't choose your company name or you don't pay an extra fee to put your company name, it just drops the word Create Space on the film or book or whatever. So I guess they do that with films too, even though this film here has been released on iTunes and various other places as well. Good question, though, Chrissy. I have no idea.
Yeah, I don't know. It just seemed kind of cool. I mean, if filmmakers can actually get to do that and upload their own stuff, that's really great. It's just I've never seen that before with all the independent films that I've watched and, you know, whatever. I've never seen it. So I figured you guys had seen that before, and I just wanted to ask. So
yeah, no. All right, so the people behind the film, let's go around there. Director is a guy named Levin Bakhia, and he wrote the story. It appears that another guy, Adrian Colucci, took his story and turned it into the screenplay. The film stars couple of folks. I'm not too familiar with them, but I think they had some TV credits. There's a woman. Her name is Spencer Locke. She is an American actress, and she's been in a number of TV shows, but nothing of note as a star, I guess. There's something called Cougar Town. It appears that she had a big role in that. But she's had guest appearances.
I want to visit Cougar Town.
Yeah. But she's had guest appearances on various shows like CSI and The Vampire Diaries and whatnot. Then we have some actors. Let's see, Sterling Knight. And he, again, has been on TV shows. But besides that, I didn't know much about him. Dean Geyer, another guy, same thing. TV shows, and nothing else that I knew. I guess he was on Glee. He was pretty popular for Glee. He played a character called Brody Weston, and then he was on Terra Nova. He played Mark Reynolds on that. Neighbors, another TV show, but either way, who knows. And then another actor of significance, last actor of significance, would be a guy named Coach Toler Dava, and he actually, unfortunately, believe it or not, passed away right after the production of this film.
Seriously?
Yeah, believe it or not. Yeah, huh. he was only 35 years old. Believe it or not. Yeah, that's a shame. Yeah, I'm not sure how he passed, but I read that after seeing this film like a month ago. I did read a bunch of reviews, and one of the reviews actually said he did pass away, and sure enough. It lists his death on April 11th of 2015. Doesn't say how he passed though. So it's a shame. That's pretty much, in other words, mostly the film is TV stars or people that we wouldn't know. So that's pretty much the only significance of the film. It's not like, you know, The Revenant or Crimson Peak, where there was a lot of big names that edited and music and all that stuff. So let's go around the table how we heard about this film and what we thought about this film. Let's start with you, Eric. Why don't you let everybody know that details?
Well, I heard about it when we were preparing for our Looking Back on 2015 episode. I was checking out top 10 lists all over the place just to see if I'd missed anything. And Landmine Goes Click showed up on a top 10 list somewhere else. And I was intrigued, so I went and checked it out, and then I think I recommended it to the rest of us here. I enjoyed the film. We'll get into details later, as we always do, so I don't want to say too much here. But I thought it was well done, and I really, really liked the ending. So that's all I'll say for now.
Okay. For me, I actually heard about it at the end of 2014 or beginning of 2015, we're looking for films of the future to check out, and I saw it on some list there. And then I completely forgot about it, and because, you know, it never appeared again in anything. And then out of the blue, Eric said, I just saw this film, Landmine Goes Click. And I said, oh, yeah, I heard about that film. And he goes, it was on iTunes. And unlike a lot of films on iTunes, it isn't listed as a top film to check out. In other words, if you go to iTunes, it lists, you know, here the top 40 most popular horror films, the top 40 most popular thrillers, whatever. Landmine Goes Click never appeared on any of those,
I had to search for it by name.
Yeah. And so I rented it, and my opinion pretty much is the same as Eric's. When we did our 2015 review list, it actually landed up as the 11th best horror film by Dark Discussion. So it just missed the top 10. There was a lot of interesting things about the film that made it, I don't want to say appealing, obviously, but a good film. And some of the things, including, as Eric said, the ending, was one of them. What about you, Mike?
I saw this in browsing on one of the various on-demand services, and I went, oh, what's this? Oh, it's a film filmed in Eastern Europe. Fuck, I hope Phil doesn't hear about this. We're going to have to do an episode. and anyway, that was probably like November or early December when it first hit. And then I didn't really – I passed it over a number of times. And then Eric decided to be the one to step on the landmine and said it didn't suck. And so I think then you saw it probably and said it didn't suck. So I said, well, I guess we're probably going to end up doing an episode and it's at the end of the year and I want to see if it doesn't suck, if it ends up on my list, which it didn't because, well, I didn't think it sucked. For the ending, personally, I had to give it a thumbs down. But it did, even despite that, would have been the first film – came very close to being the first film I gave a thumbs down to end up on my top 20 list because I think there is – a lot of stuff in here that I liked and that's neat. And it is a really disturbing movie. And if you're someone into dark films, which might be why you're listening to Dark Discussions, then it's one that you really should take a chance on because while I found it pushing through the envelope a little farther than I liked, I think other people, like maybe Phil and Eric, won't. So.
All right. That's fair. Hey, what about yourself?
I think the first time I heard about it was when you guys brought it up a few times in passing. And then, Phil, you sent me a text saying that it would be our topic for tonight. I thought the film was well made overall. I thought the actors, for the most part, did the played the characters effectively. The first act was pretty good for the most part, although I had a few moments where I just kind of rolled my eyes. And then one action that one of the characters does in order to get us into the second half was, I just thought it was kind of stupid. We'll get to that when we start going to the film itself. But then the second half was really solid. And the ending was pretty shocking. But I do feel slightly mixed about it at the same time. I mean, overall, it was a good film. It's just one I haven't mulled over where I'm more on towards a really high rating or just kind of a decent one. I mean, overall, I enjoyed it. It's just one I'm just kind of conflicted on overall.
All right, very well. Chrissy?
I first heard of this when you sent us Facebook message. I guess it was like a few weeks ago. It was before the holidays ended. And you guys had decided you were toying around with different things to do. And you were like, some other movie, which I don't remember, and Landmine Goes Click. And I thought, what the hell is Landmine Goes Click?
Oh, yeah. The other movie was Some Kind of Hate.
Oh, Some Kind of Hate. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I went and looked it up, and the description was, you know, an American tourist, whatever, whatever, while he watches his girlfriend being tortured or something. And I was like, oh, great. Torture porn. Awesome. Well, hopefully they won't do that one. And then you said you were going to do it. And I watched it today. I just don't go for that crap. I'm just like, whatever. It's over the top. I was very pleasantly surprised. There was a lot I liked about this film. I liked the ratcheting tension. I thought that was excellent. I was on the edge of my seat for the first half. I liked the opening. I liked the way the story unfolded, the neat little story twist that I honestly wasn't expecting, even though after I saw the twist, I was like, oh my God, that was so obvious. How come I didn't see it? So that was very well done. The suspense was fantastically built. The second half I thought was a little bit predictable. Once he got into repeating the scenario, because I kind of knew what was going to happen. I knew what he was going to make the women do. And it was almost like watching the same movie twice. But for the most part, I kind of have to agree with all of you on different points. I agree with what Mike said about there are certain things I liked. And I loved all the specific cultural references they made to the Georgian culture. That was really cool. I did find out, Phil, in my reading, that this was actually considered a remake. Did you read that?
I did not, no.
It's apparently some reviewers were considering this a remake of a film. It was an Austrian film. And I can't remember the name of it, but I wrote it down somewhere in one of my notes. So I'll look it up and I'll get back to it later. But it was called like Happy Hours or Happy Something. I have to look it up. I thought the violence overall was very tastefully done. I went into this expecting shocking, disgusting torture porn. And I didn't get that. I got instead a psychological thriller. So overall, I liked it. But I also kind of agree with Abe, too, that I was kind of torn. Like, do I really like this? Is this the best thing I've ever seen? I'm not kind of sure. So I'm interested to hear what all you guys have to say tonight.
Okay. Eric, do you have a synopsis of the film that readily available?
Christy just rattled it off. Trapped staying on an armed landmine, an American tourist is forced to watch helplessly while his girlfriend is terrorized and brutally assaulted.
Right. And
also, yeah, a landmine goes click.
Yeah, yeah. I was thinking about this today.
That's a weird way to sell the film.
What's that?
That synopsis.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's true. And it's somewhat false, too, because...
It's not false, but it's misleading.
Yeah, misleading, exactly. Well, the film is... before we throw up the spoiler, a couple of things about the film. It's an odd film, how it's built, because it's almost like three parts. There's a part...
setup.
The setup part, which has a big twist. And then there's the middle part, which is... the big twist, and then of course the final part, which is a big twist as well. So that's one thing that's odd about it. It could be probably thrown into I like the psychological thriller for sure, but if we break it down, whether it's a horror film or a psychological thriller or both, it falls into the revenge films as well as
definitely.
You could also say in an odd way. Because it's not directly how most of these type of films work, but rape revenge films as well. So it could be thrown into that category as well. The thing that there's two types of those type of films, the rape revenge films, is the Irreversibles and the I Spit on Your Grave, the original. But then there's the Game of Thrones, Sansa Stark, and the Saska Sisters film?
American Mary?
Bloody Mary. Yeah, American Mary. Where it's done differently. I mean, Irreversible and I Spit on Your Grave, the graphic violence of gender abuse is graphically violent. While in American Mary and, say, the Sansa Stark, it's off-screen. And this one, somewhere almost... in between, but closer to, I guess, the off screen. But
it was, I liked the way they did it. I don't like seeing that, but I like the
yes,
way they did
I agree. I thought it was tasteful. If there is such a thing as tasteful rape.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you. You can say that. I can't.
Yep.
Yeah, fair enough. So if you folks who want to figure out if this film is for you, it doesn't go as far as I Spit on a Grave or Irreversible, which are pretty horrific. It is closer to the other, but the subject itself should be noted for folks who don't want to see a film where such a scene could occur. And that's all I wanted to say about the film before we, you know, start discussing it and what we believe. What the filmmakers are trying to say and all that. So at this point, we'll put up the spoiler. So let's go ahead and talk about the film. I guess, Eric, you want to set it up about the Americans and what they're doing there? They are
they appear to be on vacation, and they're it's a weird vacation though. I don't quite understand it, but they're wandering around the Georgian countryside essentially, and two of the people are planning on getting married soon, and then there's the third wheel who's along with them.
Yeah, and he's supposed to be the best man of the.
Yeah, he's the best man.
Yeah,
and then
isn't this how Frozen started?
And then there's the guide, which was, was he supposed to be a friend of the groom?
Or yeah.
Or is he just some dude he hired?
He's supposed to be a friend of the groom.
Okay.
Yeah, I think they were like college buddies because, you know, like a lot of Europeans come to the U.S. for college. So I think that's where they originally met or something.
Yeah, and he did, Debbie, that was his name. He did have a t-shirt on that said New Jersey.
Yeah.
And just not to interrupt, Eric, but while you're talking about the weird vacation aspect.
Yeah.
They were hiking in the Caucasus Mountains. That's and right. Those are actually higher than the Alps. So okay. That is a huge tourist destination for hikers in the summer, skiers in the winter. It's just that we don't hear about it because where it because of where it is. Because Georgia is also a it's a very not historically, I guess that's the word you'd use, but it's a very strategic area. So that's why there's no surprise that there might be a landmine there. That area has been fought over for years. So just to clarify that.
And to be honest, there's been numerous – there was a big Russian invasion of Georgia about 4 years ago where there was two areas of the country that wanted to be separate. They're a minority group. And Russia basically helped them out to become – to secede. So there was –
or that's Russia's version of the story.
Well, of course. Yeah, it's all – but what it really comes down to is because of that invasion, never mind numerous other civil wars in the neighboring countries of Armenia and Azerbaijan, and never mind Russia for itself because Chechnya is right there as well, it would not be surprising to have leftover munitions, including landmines, just happen to be laying around, unfortunately.
Right, and that area was also so important that in Greek mythology, scholars think that that area of the Caucasus Mountains where they were near Tbilisi and all of that
Tbilisi was one the of capital the of Georgia.
Pillars. Yeah, was one of the pillars of I'm going way back here. It's one of the pillars that held up the world, so to speak.
Oh, and like Atlas.
It kind of, yes, exactly. And it's also, they kind of, the Greeks also said, or scholars think, do you guys know the story of Prometheus where he was chained to the rock and his liver was
and
eaten
he had
out?
The bird pecking at him and stuff.
Right. Some scholars think.
Fire?
Yes, exactly. Some scholars think that that is actually where, in terms of Greek mythology, like the Greeks' world, so to speak, that would have been the edge of their world. So that's probably where Prometheus, if you believe in the myths, would have been tied up. Just useless information you don't really need to know. But yeah, I'll shut up now. Go ahead, Eric.
Okay. So they're out in the mountains. And basically what happens is that the groom and the bride and the best man posed for a picture while the friend is got the camera. And he tells everybody to shift a little bit to their left, and they do so. And then the best man is on the end of the line there. And while they're adjusting for the picture, click, he steps on the landmine. And from there, should I just finish off the setup here?
Yeah. Just okay. Finish off the setup quick. Yeah.
So from there. He goes to call for help while the bride is freaking out. And meanwhile, we found out that the best man and the bride had an affair at one point. And it turns out that this whole thing was set up by the groom. He knows about the affair, and he basically calls her a whore and calls him an asshole and walks away with his buddy with the best man standing on a landmine.
Yeah, and a couple of things. We discover that earlier in the film, right after the credits, that the best man says, we got to tell him. And the bride keeps on saying, no, we don't have to tell him because it's over and just let it go. Because if he doesn't know, everything's fine. And we can move on with our lives and whatnot. So why the hell would you tell him? And we don't know what they're talking about, but you can kind of gather. And what we find out is the best man had already told somewhere during the hike off screen, because at that point when he confronts his future bride, a couple, like, after he leaves, as you mentioned, Eric, the best man admits to the bride that, yeah, I told him, even though you told me not to. So we'll get into that in a moment, but I just wanted to go back a second and talk about the credits. This is one of the coolest credits I've ever seen. It basically, it's like, one of those, trains that, you know, people would create in their basement with, you know, the little houses and the little trees and all that. And it's like a live action version of that, of this Jeep going through the mountains. And then when it parks, it turns into the real people. It was just kind of amazing, I thought, how it was done.
I think there is a way to do that.
Yeah, probably just with computers, right?
Well, no, where you can film real things, and it's something about the frame rate or the lighting that ends up looking like they're toys.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, and then you just would switch over to, I guess, you know, a different setting on the camera, and then you would go into real. I remember seeing footage of that a number of years ago. Somebody did as a test thing and popped up on the internet, and I've seen that technique used a few times since.
And it is pretty cool.
Yes.
Yeah, it was an excellent set.
Well, especially when you consider that a good part of this film is people toying with each other. Yeah.
And yes, that's true, even though I'm sure that wasn't intended. But yeah, that's
worked well. And also, though, before that, which is interesting, is that they show this big tower in the opening before they focus in on the toys, like people looking like toys and the car looking like toys. And it was interesting that the tower was like babbling in all languages, because it struck me as being like the Tower of Babel. And this kind of plays into the story later, because there's that whole thing about...
Yeah, they can't understand each other.
They can't even understand each other and all this other stuff. But the tower, what the Tower of Babel was really about is that in Genesis, the people who all spoke one common language everywhere in the world, they all lived in this one city, and they wanted to build a tower that reached the heavens, because technically they wanted to be equal to God. And basically God got pissed off and he made them all speak in different languages and scattered them across the globe. So why I found that particular technique interesting is the Tower of Babel, and then they all look like toys, is that it's really talking about playing God. And if you think about how Ilya plays God with them, and that you will do what I say, I am in control of you. And then in the second half of the film, Chris is like, I'm in control of you. It does sort of play into the idea that
we are all playing God.
It was just very interesting.
Never mind the groom playing God when he gets them on the landmine.
Oh, absolutely.
And never mind the fact that the best man wants to play God because he just wants to be a dink and say, I banged your future wife, and even though you're my best friend and blah, 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 because there's no reason for him to tell him. But he just wants to tell him because he's, for whatever reason, you know, sociopath.
And never mind that he has a dog, which is God spelled backwards.
Right. But even the significance of their names is interesting, because Daniel, the name Daniel, who was the groom, I believe that's, I can't remember if it's Hebrew. I know Chris is English. The name Chris, Christopher, Christian is English. But I think Daniel, who wants revenge, that name I believe is Hebrew. And it means something like judgment of God or judge of God, something like that. So it ties into that whole idea of, you know, I'm a God. And Chris means like follower of God or Samaritan or bearer of Christ, depends on which one you look at. So I kind of thought that was interesting, because they were the only two characters in the story that had truly Christian names. All the other people had kind of, you know, Georgian or Spanish, like Alicia's Spanish for beautiful, honest woman, or beautiful something. It's something like purity. Alicia, but it's Spanish. I know Alicia's Spanish. But anyway, So I just thought it all kind of tied in there. It was interesting.
So there's a couple of biblical names and a couple that weren't necessarily.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that was kind of fun. And I could have gone deeper with that, but I didn't have time today. So
before we continue, Mike, you just instant messaged about the credits. Miniature faking, you said? You can find this on Wikipedia?
Yeah, it's the technique, I guess, is called miniature faking. I didn't know it had a name. But it's how they get that effect, by using a shallow depth of field and close up. Because when you're shooting things in miniature with a macro lens, it's hard to get, you get a very, very shallow field of focus. And so that's part of it. And it just gives it that toy-like, model-like look.
Yeah, and there's a whole article about it on Wikipedia. So anybody who wants to check it out, miniature faking, just search for that on Wikipedia.
And I promise I didn't just make the whole thing up just now.
No. I see the link. So, yeah, that is interesting. I'm going to have to read that article after we end the podcast. Let's talk about this three-way thing. Now, what's your opinion? All right. So let's say
– just hold on a second. The other term it's called is tilt-shift photography. So you can Google that, and they'll give you some examples. So like I'm looking right now at a picture, it looks like a tennis match, but it really looks like toys. It's incredible.
Yeah, that is interesting how they can do it. And it's done by frames and things rather than actually computers, which is kind of cool. Now, let's talk about the three characters, the leads, the ones at the beginning, the groom, the bride, and the best man. What's your opinion? Let's say these two best friends, the two guys, and one betrays the best friend by hooking up with the fiance. And let's say, obviously, it's two to tango. It takes two to tango. So obviously, the fiance, is as quote unquote as bad as the best man.
She's an asshole.
Right. So it happened. However,
I think this is a lot ado over just some dancing. I think there's more to it than that.
So let's say basically what it is. She admits that it was a stupid mistake, and why did she do it? While the best man, seems that he wants to continue it further, because why else would he want to tell the groom except to be a dink and to have her for himself? And yet you can tell she doesn't want him anyway. So it was, she said, all right, I banged you. It was a mistake. Let's move on. I'm never going to do it again. So what's your guys' opinion of this and why he would want to do that for any other reason than just he is insane or a sociopath?
Because
or
people, no, not sociopath. You think everybody's a sociopath.
You're damn right.
everybody except Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly.
He's
Mike,
not a sure. sociopath. He's just a dick. And he
Phil Trump or Bernie. I didn't.
He thought his best friend's girl was hot, and he banged her, and he wants to keep banging her. And that's that.
Right. So here's a guy that we're assuming have been friends for a long time. Obviously, really good friends. If he's going to be the best man, and yeah, he's just a prick. Because the normal thing in other scenarios. Other films, I can't remember their names or whatever, or even books I've read where they say, should we tell, my guilt is so bad, I want to tell, but if I do, then that person's will be hurt terribly, so why even do it? But in this case, I don't even think it's guilt, right? It's like you said, Eric, he just wants to keep on banging, basically.
Right.
Any opinions?
I don't know. You said that he said that he tells
yes.
her that he told the groom while they were hiking.
There's a scene
I missed that.
No, I think the groom. Either. I think the groom figured it out.
Yeah, I think the groom.
That's how I got it.
Why would you have the fucking landmine there?
Because he still wants to get revenge on his.
I think girlfriend. It was already set up before that.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
No, he was planning.
Yeah, it was.
All right, this is what happened. This is what I remember. The groom tells her later in the film that I told him. And she goes, why the hell did you do that? So there's a scene in it. Chrissy, you may remember it. You just saw the film again today. And then what happened was is he figured it out himself anyway. And so he set this whole thing up, the groom. And And yet the guy was
planning. Okay, so he figured it out and set it up, and then the dude told him.
Anyway, yeah, exactly.
Okay, I'll buy that. Okay,
I mean, come on. I'm the only female in basically a virtual room with all men. Can you tell if your chick is screwing somebody else?
I think that's being awfully heteronormative of you.
That's a good question, Chrissy. I fortunately have not had that experience, though if I may have, and I just don't know, right? Because you don't know. So right? I don't know. I'm what's your opinion? What were you going to say? You think that most guys can figure it out?
They're pretty devious.
I think, yes, but I also think just like – you know, women can tell if you're in a relationship that there's been a shift of some kind. It may be subtle. The woman might sit there and go, oh, my God, it's not true. It's not true. But eventually they figure it out. I honestly think that although men work a little differently, they understand. They know when there's been a shift or a change in the relationship. And being that this particular guy, Daniel, went to so many extremes and he turned into this psychopath in like 2 minutes, which I thought was brilliant. I was like, oh my God, I have a feeling that he was probably the type of guy that was very possessive of her anyway and kind of figured it out on his own. And if he did, he might have searched for backup or support on that. Like, well, guys are not as dumb as all the women think they are. Like, they're pretty smart. Like, you can't necessarily pull it over on you. You know what I mean?
What about this, Chrissy? Maybe he wasn't possessive, and what it is she was his best friend. I mean, obviously, you have to choose a best man, but you can marry your best friend. And so that maybe it wasn't because he was possessive of her. It was because he's such a good friend of hers, and they probably hang out together. They probably even live together. Who knows? And then suddenly something shifts.
Right, exactly.
Everybody in this movie is a despicable human being. Let's move on.
But I mean, that's, yes, we can move on. But that was my point. You can tell. If you know somebody that well, you're going to tell if something's changed.
Yeah.
It's like you can tell if your best friend calls you and she's just kind of like, oh, and you go, what's wrong? You know, it's the same thing. Like, I just kind of felt like he probably suspected all along. And then
people suck.
And people suck. Yes.
Yes. Now let's discuss what happened. So we find out that the groom figures it out that his best friend, meaning his fiance, banged his male best friend, meaning his best man, and so he makes this devious plan, or what you could argue is even an evil plan, to hurt the two of them. We find out that. It's a red herring. That's one of the big twists as we go through. But it's still evil, even if it was not really what we expected. But let me ask you this. Obviously, he went too far because even if he didn't cause the harm that we thought he was planning to do, he obviously did something really bad. However, to be betrayed by the two closest people in your life, besides maybe your parents or if you have kids, maybe from a prior marriage, that's pretty tough, right?
I mean, I actually think that the groom's plan, if it had gone as originally planned, was fucking awesome. That would have been sweet. Because everything would have been okay and they would have been punished. It was only when the third party got involved.
He just didn't have any foresight.
Well, let me
just didn't have any foresight to the other possibilities that could go wrong, though.
Well, I don't know how much you're going to think of that. No matter how well you plan, I think what actually happens, you would have to be a pretty psychic son of a bitch to figure out what was going to happened.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty far out.
So much could go wrong there.
Oh, yeah. The whole premise is ludicrous. And really, when you think about it, well, if it had worked, it would have been brilliant, but I find it hard to believe that if we're going to pretend for a moment this is real, that anybody would think this is a good plan. We're going to go halfway around the world. We're going to put a fake landmine in the middle of nowhere, and we're going to walk into the point where the person I want manages to step on that one particular landmine, and then I'm going to laugh and run away. To me, a little bit like It Follows, and that this is clearly a morality play, and so I don't hold it to absolute pure story logic. Right? You know, it is an overly elaborate plot.
Yeah.
And you know, you'd think, like, dude, can't you just, like, piss in her cornflakes or something? I mean, isn't that would be so much easier. And you know,
I don't take infidelity lightly, and I think the plan was awesome.
So I don't take infidelity lightly, and I'm just saying as a revenge plan, it was a little overly complicated. That is not a criticism of the story. Because you need to have that to have the story, right? You know, you can't have a movie. And I'm willing to, there's like all sorts of logistical problems, I think, with the ending that if you're going to let it bother you, like, I don't know, running in heels away from a dinosaur, that it could destroy your enjoyment of the film. But I don't think it's, that's not, I don't think what the point, this is not meant to be a hyper-realistic film.
Right.
This is an allegory, a parable about the dangers of genetically modified dinosaurs weaving landmines in the middle of Eastern Europe. But yeah, it's a neat idea, and it's certainly, and this is, by the way, what you need if you want to be a successful independent film. You know, telling a story about an 80s throwback with a slasher in the woods is not going to grab a lot of people's attention because there's a gajillion of them out there that you're going to have to deal with. This is a simple idea. My mother asked me, "What are you podcasting about tonight?" And I told her about the film, and knowing that she's not one she'd be interested in, but she very quickly got the idea. You know, grasp the concept. And that's the sort of thing you want, that quick, simple, high concept. Anybody can understand it. Thing that will get people to watch. And I think they do that really well here. And it's an interesting concept. It's like I said, it's a weird roundabout way to get revenge, but you know, who am I to say?
Well, and that's the thing that's interesting about the film, like, too, is that you think the film is about one thing, which is a guy getting revenge on his two best friends who literally and figuratively fucked them over.
But more specifically, they did it literally.
Exactly. Well, that's why I said literally and figuratively.
Literally is that really, I think, what bothered them.
So what happens is then the movie changes completely and is completely different than what we all thought, which makes it even more interesting. And then there's the Korean revenge piece of the end, which is even more interesting. So that's why it's a strange film in that way. But you're absolutely right. It's generally original, or at least catchy. And I put catchy, and I mean, I don't mean it, you know, like a tune, but catchy in the sense that it's like, oh, that's an idea that's new. It's, or feels new, even if it not necessarily is. Also, Bill,
the name that I read in the review that said that it was based on another Austrian film. The name of that film is called Funny Games.
Yep.
Funny Games.
Yep. I don't know anything about it. I don't know anything about it. I just know that a couple of different reviewers referenced it.
Mm. Okay. It's similar, but not similar, if that makes any sense. I don't know how to explain it.
Funny Games?
Yeah, I have both. Director Henke, He actually directed Academy Award nominated film last year that was up for Best Foreign Language Film. Before that, he used to do, you know, genre films, and he basically did two versions of Funny Games. One that was in German because it was Austrian, and then he made a English language remake, basically scene by scene remake, a couple of years later. And I have
the remake.
I have both, and I used to like the original better, but to be honest, the remake is actually the better of the two films. And it has the same idea of revenge, but it is definitely a little different. But I could see why they would say it's similar.
It's a home invasion movie. I mean, and it's not a home invasion movie about a landmine that comes into someone's home and holds them hostage. It's
I don't see how
that touches on similar themes, but
yeah, that's
this
probably
is like
that.
Saying that. No, this is like, you know, Jaws is a remake of Taxi Driver. I don't see it. You know, it's actually be the other way around. Wait, which came first?
Believe it or not, I think Jaws may have came a year.
Okay, so
first.
Taxi Driver being a remake of Jaws. You know, it's just because there's this guy stalking through the streets of New York, sort of like a shark swimming through the ocean. No, it's just.
All right, so it's possibly a bad analogy, Chrissy, but maybe some of the same themes.
Well, I just wanted to ask you guys about it because a couple of reviews I read after I saw the film mentioned it, and I'd never heard of it. So I just wanted to
You know what? You know what? I think if we take away, Mike, you're somewhat right, but if you take just the third act of Landmine Goes Click, I could see some of the resemblance. But either way, let's move on. I mean, so obviously, let's just move on. We get the idea.
Moving along, folks.
Sorry. Yeah, I know we're moving on. Also, Phil, I liked the fact that this film played with the idea of the traditional concept of if you step on a landmine and don't step off it, it's going to blow up.
Yep.
I like what they did with that because most people assume that if you step on a landmine and you take your foot off, it's going to blow up. And yet the guy says that it's an SMI 35 or whatever landmine. That was known as the Bouncing Betty. That was like the most famous landmine in World War II because it blew up the second you stepped on it. There was just a 4-second delay.
Please, for the love of God, tell me you looked this up and not that you knew it from heart.
No, I really did actually look it up. I did not know it. All right. You guys could be okay. But when he said that, I was like, ooh, let me go look that up.
I know Bouncing Betty, but did you know the model was a Bouncing Betty?
I knew the model was a Bouncing Betty only because my dad was a World War II freak. I didn't know anything about how it worked or the 4-second delay or that it was full of shrapnel or any of that. All I knew was that it was called the Bouncing Betty. The only other thing I knew was that they replaced them halfway through World War II because the original model was too expensive to make. Those are the only two things I knew about it. I had to go look it up because I didn't know how it worked.
Now, Chrissy, the groom, what's his name? Chris or Dan?
Daniel.
Okay, so Daniel, let's continue and explain what's going on. Is basically what it is that Daniel sets up this very strange revenge, or that Eric says is awesome and Mike says is a little unrealistic. But either way, he sets it up.
Does it mean it's not awesome?
Yeah, he sets it up, and basically what it is he basically set up his best man to die on a landmine, and he tells his fiance to go bleep herself. And then he and his Georgian friend leave them to die, basically. But the big twist is the landmine is fake. And he basically told them basically to both go fuck off, but he didn't really was planning to kill either of them. It was just a fake. So
right, he just wanted them to stand there for several hours, thinking that they were going to die,
right?
And then realize what a couple of assholes they are.
Exactly.
But it's just like Ilya said at the very end, kind of like you dumbasses. Like if you'd step on it, it would have blown up anyway.
Right.
Like you don't step off it. Like that's
right, because
like a Hollywood
because of
cliche.
The model.
Yeah.
Because it's the model. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So let's get into that scene, the Ilya scene. So basically, the fiance is pissed, but she still obviously likes the groom. I mean, likes the best man because the groom is already gone, and she doesn't want to abandon the best man because of his situation. But she's still pissed at him because he just ruined her life. At least in her eyes, because in theory she ruined her own life because she shouldn't have banged him in the first place.
Whore!
Right, exactly. But but assuming the fiance wouldn't have found out that she banged the best man, in her eyes the best man fucked up everything. But she ain't gonna leave him. So let's get into the fact, Ilya. Let's start talking about this guy. So there's a guy and his dog that show up, right? Another hunter or hiker or whatever.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
And we all know that he immediately has Phil's sympathies because he has a dog.
Phil, were you losing this shit when the dog got shot?
Oh, that's what
I wanted to know.
Oh, I was pissed, but you're going a little too heavy. it just makes me hate the guy even more. Not only Eric, right? Not only is he an infidelity scumbag, right? But he kills a dog.
Well, here's the thing. But you're going too fast now, too. When this guy shows up, he's like fucking with these two, and I don't understand why.
Sociopath?
He might be a sociopath. I'll give you that one.
Thank you.
This guy Ilya shows up, and he's like clearly crazy, and he's messing with them. And my point was just that Georgia is a very poor country, and he's out there hunting. And what else is there to do? He's obviously kind of crazy anyway. And, you know, there's nothing to do out there. Like, all you have to do is understand the history of Georgia and how war-torn it is to, like, kind of see how these people could just lose their shit. Like, literally, there's nothing going on. It's beautiful country, but there's nothing there, you know? So
I'm thinking, considering how quickly he just tried to attack them in the first place, I think maybe this isn't the first time he's done something like this. You know, maybe this is a second life he's been actively living behind his family's back.
All right. So basically, he plays with these people because, well, that's the thing that's interesting about the character is he doesn't attack. We basically find out pretty soon, quickly, that he's an unsavory type of person because he says he'll help, but he keeps on throwing conditions and things like that and whatnot. And so he's a little weird, but he's not attacking them, right? Because here's a guy that's on a landmine. The question is now, does he think they actually believe it's a real landmine? Because right off the bat, he knows it's not real. And, so he's trying to feel him out that way. And that's why he doesn't attack him right away. Or do you think he just likes playing with them because he's a sick human being?
I think it's both.
He's definitely nuts. He's definitely nuts. I mean, there was absolutely no reason to do so otherwise, other than trying to, you know, play God. You know, he had a perfect situation to exude his power on them.
Right. And they do mention later in the film, he makes some comment on how, or someone makes a comment on how he can be a bit of a prick when he drinks.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, you have a man in the woods hunting. Drinking is probably involved.
Yeah.
I also know when I worked at the state park, we would usually get a lot of Georgian people there that looked just like Ilya, except they all wore Speedos.
Oh, God.
And I'm thinking that probably fucked up the circulation to his brain. So,
were these people immigrants to the States, or were they on vacation from Georgia?
I didn't get all that detail in their background. They were mostly, right. Most of them were people who probably were immigrants who were coming up from New York City to get away from it all, you know, where with several thousand other people in the park.
Yeah, sure.
Well, and here's the thing about this whole setup that actually bothered me, and it wasn't Ilya so much as it was, what was the best friend's name, Chris?
Chris.
Yes. Chris.
Yeah, Chris. Chris was being, okay. Chris thinks he's standing on a landmine, and that if he shifts his weight too much, he will die, okay?
Yeah.
And then this dude shows up, Ilya shows up, and Chris starts being all sorts of a dick to him.
Oh, yeah,
and I'm like,
that was ridiculous.
What do you think you're doing when you're in that position? Why are you being all aggro on this guy? Why? You've got no leverage. You can't back up your talk. This guy could just knock you off that thing and blow you to pieces in any given second.
I mean,
obviously, there's a point where Ilya's behavior goes over the top, and then you can kind of understand Chris's behavior to him. But up until that point, Chris is still being a dink, and there's no good reason why other than he's an asshole.
And Eric,
it didn't make much sense to me.
Eric, never mind the fact that even let's say he wasn't on a landmine and he was just in the woods. When a guy comes up to you with and he's holding a gun, whether he's threatening or not, you're not going to be an asshole to him because he's got a gun.
Right.
Oh, well,
right?
First of all, let's never underestimate the human ability to be an asshole.
Especially the quote unquote American, right?
No, anybody. Really, anybody.
Yeah.
Anyone can be an asshole.
Yeah, I mean, especially the fucking French Canadians. But, look, we can all be assholes. All of us. And there are certain people who are so self-involved that it doesn't matter that they're dealing with a person with a gun. They can't honestly believe that anyone would ever have the temerity to blow their fucking head off.
Okay.
Right? Well, and actually, Mike, you might be right about that, because in the beginning when he's like, let's tell him, well, that too, but but when he's like, let's tell him, there's a comment that I think she makes, or even he makes in jest, where he says, oh, what do you think? I want to break you guys up. And I was like, that's exactly what he wants to do, because he wants that piece of meat all for himself.
Oh, piece of meat. Man's got to eat.
No, wow. That's a fair point, because that's how he's looking at them as a social.
No, it was the way he said it. I was like, yeah. Wow, he just wants to bang her. He's not even thinking of her as a person.
It was the way he said it.
That particular character, the way he said it was like, oh, what do you think? I want to break you guys up. And I was like, yeah, asshole. That's exactly what you want to do. I can see it in your eyes. Like, come on.
And this is one of the things I guess I have an issue with the film, is that I'm really not on board with anybody.
Yeah, there's nobody you like in the film.
Right. And even now, when you find out that the landmine is fake, we are really, really deep into the film.
Yeah.
So early on, when the groom sets up his friend, you know, I don't gel with the whole cheating thing. I don't. But blowing him up is a little bit far, is all I'm going to. For revenge. So I couldn't even really be with him. And even if I was, he was gone into the first 15 minutes of the film.
Right.
And then you get the douchebag who was the cheater.
Yeah.
Who continues to be a bit of an obnoxious dick when he has absolutely no reason to be, as Eric has pointed out, throughout the rest of the film.
Well, never mind the fact, if I could just interject for 1 second, Mike, never mind the fact that he thinks by that he's going to be marrying this girl or banging her again, first of all, which he's insane. And second of all, he thinks that by telling his best friend about the affair is going to do something that's going to make the girl be happy about that. I mean, he's just totally clueless. But go on, Mike.
And then when Ilya comes along, as much of a douche as Chris can be, he isn't enough of a douche to justify everything he does, which he doesn't even do to Chris. Right? I mean, he does to the girl.
Well, yeah.
Whose name I keep forgetting?
Elisa.
We can just call her whore.
Okay, who does to whore. And her is the closest sympathetic character.
Alicia
you have,
is her name.
But she's still
a cheater.
Banged around behind her guy's back. And so she's still a cheat. You know, that's unforgivable. And she clearly feels bad about it. And no, she doesn't deserve what happens to her. But in the end, she isn't the main character that we're guessing. So, right, she's not sympathetic. So really it was hard for me to really root for any one particular character or to feel great about anybody's revenge, because the person getting the revenge I don't like enough to go, yay, get that bastard.
Well, I was hoping that the landmine would blow up and that all three of them would get blown to bits.
That would be awesome. And the dog eats them. Eats the leftovers.
Oh, crap.
On a side note, Mike, the one thing that was oddly a flaw, you could say, or you could say it was genius, depending on how you look at it. And some of the reviews actually mentioned it too, that I read, which is by the end of the movie, you are actually have sympathy in some cases, depending on how you look at it, with Ilya, which is odd. And I don't know if you don't.
I don't agree.
Again, I'm not saying that we should. Or that I did, or anybody that watched this film did, but what the reviewers wrote was saying that it's odd that in some cases those reviewers felt that more sorry for Ilya by the end of the film than these other people, and I don't think that was intended.
I have sympathy for those other people, but they have not been in the film long enough for me to really care about them, and
yeah,
I certainly
I
don't. It's. Then they're meant as a torture device for Ilya, and he was just such a massive douchebag. I can't believe he actually had a dog.
Well, and also, too, getting back to Chris being the douchebag with his foot on the landmine and, like, being an asshole to Ilya, he's standing there with the gun while Alicia's being raped. Now, I don't profess to be a gun expert. I don't shoot. I don't know that much about it. I used to shoot skeet 100 years ago. That's about all I know about it. But I'm sitting there going, he could have easily, if he was any kind of shot, because he was close enough, he could have at least fired that gun and hit Ilya in the ass enough to distract him to get her off her. to get him off Alicia. And he didn't do it.
He was probably afraid of hitting her, too, because wasn't it loaded with birdshot or something?
Yeah, but, you know, that's what Ilya told them. Would have been minor injuries compared to it, but it doesn't matter. He could have hit, he could have at least distracted the guy and then gotten him to stop, at least, injured him enough so he couldn't go further.
There's one thing that oddly happens, though, Chrissy, is that he must be a bad shot because he is the one that actually kills the bride. Because when we find her, basically she dies, right? All right, so basically what happens is Ilya basically treats them like trash. He makes her, you know, walk around like a dog and all, you know, all this stupid stuff.
Her panties in her mouth.
Yeah, exactly. And I'll help your friend and blah, blah, blah. So he's, you know, we'll talk about that in more detail if we want. And then what happens is eventually he just goes overboard. He says, all right, enough's enough. And, I'm raping you. And he rapes the girl. And while he's raping her, the guy, Chris, is able to, whether he got it right before or during the rape, he gets the guy's gun because Ilya just, you know, leaves the gun on the ground. And he decides to shoot. And when he shoots, the dog is smart enough to know, you know, this is an enemy of my master, jumps at him. He falls off the landmine while he's pulling the trigger, and he shoots the girl in the neck. And basically, he mortally wounds the girl. So he's a bad shot.
Okay,
and basically what happens is that he wakes up after falling off the landmine, and Ilya's pretty much tossed her. I think she's still alive at that point.
Yeah, she's more than alive.
She's not playing much, though.
Right. Tossed her in with him into this ditch they dug, and basically says, you moron, you watch too many movies. If you step on a landline, it goes off immediately. Asshole. And walks away.
Right.
Now, this is the part where I had some problems, because what Ilya does here leaves the situation in the second half of the film, and I was thinking, like, you know, again, when it happens, I literally said to the screen, dude, what do you expect to happen? You left him alive. He's not dead. He literally says you're walking away, he's going to kill you. Why, are you surprised he actually showed up at your house?
Yeah, all right. I see your point. All right, so you're...
It was a little weird that he showed up at the house.
Well, it's still the fact he left him alive. You honestly think he's just going to limp back to America and be like, hey, forget it about it, you know?
Whatever.
Yeah, whatever. It was bad vacation, you know. Fuck it, you know.
No, he's an idiot. The mannequin. He go. He's a weak pussy.
All right. Well, this is the thing that's interesting about the film, or not interesting, but Abe's point, which is basically there's a flash forward, and we don't know what happens. We don't know if the groom, if he goes to the Georgian police and explains what happens, and then they go out for a manhunt. To find whoever did this horrible thing, raping the girl and then leaving her for dead and all this other stuff. Or if the groom buries the girl and then says, all right, I'm off to go get my revenge. And we don't know what happens because, again, they just flash forward. So
just a slight correction. It's not the groom.
Oh, you're right. The best man. Sorry. So the question Abe is asking then is, if this guy was willing to rape this girl and then just throw her into the ditch dead, even if he didn't kill her, he's leaving her to die, why didn't he then kill the best man too? Because if he leaves the best man alive, who in all seriously has no injuries except maybe a bite from a dog and a bump on the head from hitting a rock when he fell, wouldn't he go to the cops, never mind what happens at the end of the film? So that's a fair point, Abe.
Yeah, but at the same time, you got to look at cultural differences. Some parts of the world, I have no idea whether Georgia is one of them. Not all cultures are as offended by rape as America is. It's a part of life in some areas of the world, and that's a horrible thing, but it's the truth. So it could be that Ilya was just not thinking that it was all that big of a deal that he raped this girl, and he was just planning on raping her and leaving, because that's how things go.
But
I don't know.
Yeah, no, but then I don't think he would have had the same reaction when his daughter got involved later.
Right. Okay, that's a fair point.
And, you know, it's for all we know, Phil, he killed the best man, the groom at some point, or was planning on it. Or the same, but the truth is the groom had no clue any of this was going to happen.
Right.
So, I'm not going to say the groom was necessarily innocent. It was a prank that when you realize the landmine was harmless, it was in the end just a traumatic prank that with minimal risk associated with it. It just so happened that this rapey asshole came along and really ruined what, you know, their day. So I could see maybe he wouldn't have the same animosity because, and also he did fuck over the groom.
Right. Well, I don't even mean that, Mike. I think what I mean is Ilya. Why didn't Ilya kill the best man? Like
I don't think Ilya ever had any intention of killing anybody. He didn't actually shoot the girl.
That's right.
And he witnessed everything that happened between the groom and the best man and the girl, right? So he knows what the situation is. He knows that the people that led them out there are now gone. And he leaves him there with a mortally wounded girlfriend, figuring that he's going to have his hands full with that and he'll never see him again. I guess what actually happened is that at some point Ilya dropped his wallet and Chris found it. And that's the only way he's able to track him down to his house.
Oh, that's right. He found the wallet. You're right. Yeah.
And Ilya did not foresee that happening because why would he?
Right. Now, there's a difference between rape and murder. And I don't want to get into an argument as to which is worse because I've been in that before. But it's just because you're going to rape somebody doesn't mean you're going to murder somebody and vice versa.
Right.
You know, amoral people have weird ways of drawing lines that may not make any sense to you or I. Right. Yep. But, you know, they do that. You know, they do draw that line.
Now, if we really look deep into this film, we could see some other flaws that Abe kind of brought up, which is, okay, you figure the guy left DNA, right? So all you have to do is do the DNA and then maybe they could get a match or whatever. I mean, there's all these things that are questionable. But again, you know, we see a lot of things, I mean, movies where a crime has occurred. If we really dig deep, you know, in a year, they could probably find out the guy and who did it, whatever.
But here's the thing.
Technically,
Chris killed her. He doesn't want the cops involved with this.
Well, that's true. That's an excellent point. Because but even also, though it's still third-degree manslaughter.
But
he's broken at that point. He's pretty much insane by the time we next see him. You know, he's not actually thinking of a full deck of cards when we next see him. He's completely just off his hinges. So, of course, he's not going to get the cops involved. He wants to settle the score.
I agree with Abe, but also I think what we have to consider is that we're talking about a different country here. And they depicted Georgia very well. There were some nice cultural sensibilities there, like all of the pictures of the Madonnas on the mantle.
Yeah,
you know,
they're
Georgia.
Very religious Christian country. Yeah.
Right. They really are. They're very Orthodox.
Yeah,
they're Eastern not Orthodox. Russian. They're actually.
Yeah, they're Eastern Orthodox.
Well, yeah, but it's. There's a Georgian Orthodox church.
Right. But all Orthodox churches are called Eastern Orthodox. And then each Eastern Orthodox.
Right. Because there's Russian Orthodox. Right. There's actual Oriental.
Serbian.
Called Oriental Orthodoxy, all that stuff.
Right.
But either way, they're
Christians. They're Christians.
Right. They're basically Christians. Yeah. But like 88% of the people in that country are heavily Orthodox. So when you think of Ilya's character through the lens of that, and he's out there and he just wants to go rape and have a little fun or whatever.
And he's drunk.
You're talking about a country where that shit is taken seriously. Like these people have to sneak around, basically. The other thing is that the police and the way that we think of government and law here in this country is not the same as it is over there. Georgia has always been a country. First of all, it's not even sure if it's Asian or European. The Georgians themselves, which they don't even call themselves Georgia. I forget what the typical name, the the name is that they call that themselves.
Well, that's a fair point, Chris, but I mean, Germany in German isn't German. It's Allah. Right.
But my point is just that you're talking about a country that has been taken over or fought over so many times that these people don't trust the government. They don't trust the law. They don't trust the government. You're talking about a lawless, not lawless, but a country that, what chance does an American have to go complain? Really? The Americans don't care. You know, they're not going to care. They're going to be like, you're a tourist in our country. We don't care. So it almost goes back to The Revenant where Mike was kind of saying, don't put 21st century sensibilities onto a 19th century situation. This is almost the same thing. We're talking about putting our sensibilities in this country as we live now with law and government and all that onto a country that has been war torn, that has been fought over so many times where, you know, the people there don't trust the government. They trust family. Family is such a strong unit for them. It's stronger than it is here. So when they need something, they rely on other family members. They don't necessarily go to the government or to the law. There's no, there's hardly any social services there. There's no social services over there. There's nothing. So, you know, if you go into, I don't want to say the backwoods because that's the wrong term, but if you go into like the farmlands, let's say of Georgia, you're going to run into people that are living like they lived in the 1700s or 1800s. It's a very different world. So it made sense to me. What I thought happened in that transition was he went home, collected himself, got his shit together, and then decided to come back. Now, what he decided to tell the cops over here about the people who disappeared, who knows?
Right.
Or maybe he just went to Tbilisi, which is the nearest city, and he just was hanging out there in order to figure himself out. Because when he shows up again, he's speaking the language, partially. Right.
And that's true. And he has the whiffle.
Which he didn't in the first half.
Completely different. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, so and in the end, what he did in the interim isn't that important. You can kind of fill in enough blanks to get you there.
Right.
You know, right. You don't need like the training montage.
Right, right. So two things can be answered is that we don't need the montage, as Mike just said, and why Ilya didn't kill him is because he isn't a murderer. He's just a rapist, I guess. Right?
Yeah.
Right, or he's just really freaking incompetent.
Right. Well, right. That's fair, too. Yeah, yeah. Let's move on. Let's get to the next part. So basically, the girl is dead, dies in the hole. Basically, the hole was dug by the girl because they were hoping that he, meaning Chris, would jump into the hole and escape a blast from the landmine when it does go off. And so it, in theory, becomes her grave in a sense, ironically. And so we flash forward and we meet a new people in the film. We meet a mother and her daughter in a normal home, you know, like you would find anywhere, you could find in any country, probably any European or North American country. And they're basically, the daughter saying, and they're speaking Georgian, is saying to the mother, she and her friends want to go to get on a train and go to another country, which in this case would be Russia, and to the city of Moscow, which is obviously a big hip city, and basically go to the discotheques and whatnot there. And the mother saying, you know, being the typical, not really a dink, but, you know, like, yeah, I know what you're going to do. You're just going to get drunk and get laid, whatever, and I don't want you to do that. And the daughter goes, oh, come on, I'm an adult now, I'm 18, whatever, and whatnot. And that's pretty much the setup, right? It's just, you know, a funny little setup of a mother-daughter relationship where while they're doing laundry, you know, hanging stuff up on the clothesline in the backyard, basically. So what do we want to go from here? Did you guys know it was Chris right from the beginning? Because I at the first like 3 minutes of the film of this scene, I didn't even know it was Chris because the haircut was changed.
No, I actually thought it was the groom. I was really confused. I know, really. I was like, oh my God, what happened? Are we in the past? Are we in the future? What's going on? I wasn't quite sure at all. So.
Yeah, I, for me, I was a little confused too. So like, what is this? Who is this? And I didn't get, it wasn't until I saw Ilya when they show Ilya in the backyard, in the garden, collecting, you know, apples or whatever the hell he was doing, that I figured like, oh, this is Ilya's home and this is Ilya's family. And what happens is basically Chris is there pretending he's an American, trying to, and lost, and I need directions is basically what it is, right?
Right.
And they basically, being polite people, say, you know, if you want to stay for dinner, you can, even though they don't want him to really, but, you know, it's just a nice thing to say. And he says, oh, yeah, I'll do it. Absolutely. And so it's like, okay, this awkward situation, but, you know, hey.
Well, the awkward situation was one of my favorite parts of the movie because the wife and the daughter don't know who this guy is, have no idea that there's a past between him and Ilya. And then Ilya shows up and starts being a total dick to him. Like, get the fuck out of here. And his wife is horrified. She's like, why are you being so rude? And I thought that whole dynamic was pretty awesome.
Yeah, it was interesting because you're right. Because here it is, the wife and daughter have no idea what's going on, and they're thinking, I think she even thinks maybe he's on the bottle again or something, right? I mean, and also it's interesting too is that at this time of the film, they're trying to make Ilya, he's already off the bottle, right? I mean, because they talk about later in this scene that he's quote unquote changed his life,
right?
A little bit, you know. But I mean, again,
but he doesn't want to admit to his wife and daughter what it is he did, whatever it was, 3 months earlier.
Yeah, or even 6 months, or who knows how long. We have no idea how long.
Yeah. I mean, I was weirdly in a similar situation, but it's where we had a retirement dinner with a teacher who was forced to retire.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. Because he had basically bullied and harassed a student, not sexual, but just.
Yeah, he was a dick.
And so he's there, and because Pam didn't know that was this person, we ended up having to sit next to them during the dinner, and nobody else would sit with us at the table. So I mentioned something that had happened to this student, and I said, oh, you'd probably be happy to hear this. I told them what had happened to the student. And all along, they'd been making snide remarks about the administration and stuff, where it was clear he had not told his wife why he was really retiring. And so when the wife asked, well, who is this kid? He just started to stutter and stammer because he couldn't tell her that this was the kid who basically cost him his job because he was an asshole.
Right.
Right. And so the same kind of thing here, and obviously a much worse circumstance, is he can't let his wife know what he did.
Right.
Because they would never look at him the same way again. They may never ever have anything to do with him again. And he's obviously been lying to maybe – you know, for all we know, let's say he's been, whatever it was, 6 months. Maybe, you know, he goes home and he's like, holy fuck, I killed the girl, you know, or I'm responsible for this girl dying. And, he, you know, that changes his life around.
Right.
But he's never told his wife why he did it. And as soon as she finds out that, well, it wasn't because you had a spiritual moment, you know, or you saw the sunrise coming over the hill and you thought, oh, my God, what a beautiful world. I'm going to change my ways. You know, that. You raped and humiliated a girl who's a little older than your daughter, and indirectly got her murdered. That I think is much bigger of an issue than I fucked your best friend.
Right. Well, and never mind the fact that, and obviously this is not even in the same category, but even it, just to find out that he was unfaithful, whether it was rape or not, that too is can make people divorce. Never mind. Oh, mm-hmm. Not only you're a rapist and you're a criminal and you're all this other stuff. Never mind. Something.
I don't mind that you had to kill her, but did you have to fuck her too?
Well, that's the thing. So everything. This woman's life and her daughter's life would be completely ruined.
Right, and because this wasn't like a drinking and driving accident. This wasn't. Right. I got into heated argument at a bar and I hit somebody with a bottle and they died. You know, what he did was just so cold and casually cruel.
Cold blood torture.
right? I mean, just vicious and mean-spirited at its core. It's not an easily forgivable thing.
Right, right. So there's this awkward dinner, and eventually Ilya convinces him to leave. And then as he's leaving, he says, "I'll meet you down by the road in 15 minutes. And Chris is like, "Nah, that's not good for me. I'll be there in an hour." I thought that was kind of smooth how he was just like casually manipulating him, exerting some power over him. And then what happens is that Chris shows back up with the dog, who's now severely injured. Did he shoot him? Was there a gunshot?
Yes.
Okay.
I guess it was, yeah. I don't remember the gunshot.
I pretty much thought that he shot him or hurt him or something.
Well, he's a silencer, so maybe...
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know what? It really doesn't matter, but all that matters is that he mortally wounds the dog.
Yes, he wounds the dog and carries it back up to the house and says, "Oh my God, there was an accident. I hit your dog with my car," and then gets back into the house that way. So he's back in the house, and Ilya comes back in, and this is when things start heating up, and basically Chris is exerting pressure on Ilya to try and confess to his wife what he'd done, and he won't do it, so he keeps on doing more and more horrible things. I forget the sequence of events, but along the way he shoots him in the leg, and then he makes Ilya's daughter retrieve her panties in her mouth like a dog, just like Ilya did to the bride.
Yeah.
And then, and meanwhile, the mother's horrified through all of this, screaming and crying and everything.
Now, Eric, if I could interject for 1 second, the earlier when he says, "I'll meet you in the road, you know, in an hour or whatever," uh-huh. Ilya said, "Let's not get my family involved. This is between you and me and not my family. Just leave them alone." So, uh-huh. So he wanted to do that. And then at this point, what you're discussing now, this is when the daughter and the mother both figure out that, oh, you know this guy?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so, he never does come out and say it, does he?
Does
Chris tell the story eventually? No, he doesn't, does he?
No. They never tell the story.
No, he sort of tells it in broken pieces. Like, yeah. he says, because I was sitting there holding my breath going, "Oh, my God, tell the story. Mm-hmm. And while he's got Lika kind of right around her neck, he's like,
yeah,
"Alicia didn't get this opportunity, blah, blah." So it's hinted at, but he doesn't really come out and say it.
And the thing that's horrifying about this scene isn't necessarily the humiliation that he's doing to Ilya, even though that, you know, even if Ilya's a scumbag, I mean, I don't think anybody should be tortured. But the thing that's disgusting is that the daughter and the mother, or wife, are Philly, even though Mike said, you know, you don't know him well enough, to me, they were sympathetic enough, and they're just people. They're, you know, they're just your next door neighbors. They're just good people. They're not anything bad at all. And Chris, the groom, he decides to, I mean, not the groom, the best man, he decides to basically torture them as well. And that is what's horrific, because here's these two innocent women who are now being, tortured, or whatever, any word you want to use for torture. And you know, they don't deserve it at all.
Well, yeah, but here's the thing, though. I believe, and you can disagree with me if you want, I believe that if at any point, if Ilya had fessed up, he would have stopped.
Oh, yeah, you could be right.
I believe that, too.
Yeah, you could be right. Whether or not they still didn't deserve to be put in that situation, the two women, but that's fair, Eric, that he may have stopped. Yeah.
So I believe he was just trying to put pressure on Ilya, and his real objective was to get Ilya to confess what he'd done to his wife and his daughter. Right. And then it all goes wrong. Because eventually what happens is that he's escalating and escalating. And eventually he says, "We're going to play a little game. I'm going to put a bullet in this gun and spin it and fire at your daughter." If you answer the question, if you don't, I'm gonna put another bullet in and spin it again.
Yeah, Russian lit.
And so he starts playing this game and shoots the daughter and seems to be caught by surprise when it happens because he really wasn't expecting it to go that far. And you get this shot, and I'm sure Christy can get into the religious aspects of all the camera shots there. At the end. Basically, to me, this ending had a lot. I'm not going to say it was the same, but it had a lot in common with the ending of I Saw the Devil, in that there's this character that's been wronged. Their significant other was killed, and they go out for revenge, and when they finally get it, they realize they've become just as bad of the person they were going after and don't know where to go from there.
Yeah, I actually really loved the ending. Was it, I think, Mike who said he didn't like it? One of you said you didn't like the ending?
Mike.
That was Mike.
That was you. Okay. I liked the ending only because I thought it was amazing in those last couple of minutes of the movie when they held only on him and the parents are crying and you can look into this Chris's eyes and see everything he's feeling in his eyes.
Right.
And for somebody who spent 95% of his life doing Disney Channel stuff, I was like really impressed. I was like, wow. You know, I buy what this guy's feeling. You could see every emotion, the initial shock that he actually did it, the pain, the sorrow, and then, like you said, Eric, then he realizes he's the same monster that Ilya really is.
Right.
And I thought the ending, that last minute or 30 seconds, it felt like it went on for a super long time. And there was a lot of religious symbolism in the way they were holding their bodies. And I mean, there was a lot there. And that part I really liked. I just thought it was just going on. I think the only problem I had with the second part of the film was that because I knew about the panties and the mouth and the dog and all that, them replaying that specifically seemed so derivative to me. It was almost like watching a second movie on top of the first one.
Okay.
I almost wish he had gotten not so – he could have still done the same things as Punishment but just shaken it up a little bit so it was a little bit different because I knew what to expect at that point.
Uh-huh.
I didn't expect the ending. I didn't expect him to actually shoot her. I was like, holy shit. Like when that was, I was like, oh my God, you know, but just, oh, now he's going to make her crawl like a dog and now he's going to make her do this and now he's going to say that. In the beginning of that second half, when he's first torturing them, he makes casual references, but they're not quite the same. And for me, that worked. But then he just started repeating what Ilya did. And I thought they could have continued that, burying it up and shaking it up, and it would have been better.
So your problem wasn't that he tortured them, it's that he wasn't he lost points on originality.
Absolutely.
You would have been okay if he tortured them in strange, exotic new ways.
Yeah, you know what? 7.9.
She wouldn't give him a 10. She went with 8.5 because of the degree of difficulty.
Yeah, 7.0.
Phil, are you there?
Yes. I'm actually trying to re-add Abe. He dropped off. There's something fishy going on with my Skype.
Because I keep getting a phone call and I don't know.
Somebody's been trying to call me too, and I've just been ignoring it.
So yeah, I was like you, Chrissy. I did not expect. I was completely shocked when the bullet actually went off. I mean, we should have known it was going to happen, but it was still like it wasn't expected because I didn't expect that they were going to kill off the daughter and whatnot. And then how they end it, which is just showing this camera on Chris's face and then going to black, you know.
Well, it
reminded me of I Saw the Devil's Ending a lot.
Yeah, that's what Eric was saying too, yeah.
Yeah, because, you know, once he finally gets his revenge, the reality of the entire situation just settles right in. He just completely shuts down. He completely breaks apart. You know, he's no longer stoic or confident. He's just empty. And it once again just shows that, you know, even if you manage to, you know, get back at whoever has wronged you, in the end, you're left with nothing, and really, no, neither side has anything left. Ilya and his wife have lost their daughter, and Chris has lost the woman he loves, and his soul, and he's stained his hand with blood. No one wins there. And I think what was really brilliant was just the shot of his focus on Chris's shrinking back and just hearing the sobs of the parents. I thought that was a brilliant final shot.
Hey, Mike, you were going to say?
I said the thing is with I Saw the Devil, unless I'm forgetting a plot point, the guy's going after a serial killer,
yep.
And he fucks up some other criminals and serial killers along the way.
Yep.
Here, he basically to get revenge on this person, on Ilya, he does attack two innocent people. And yes. Does all the things that he's getting to them that he's basically motivating his own revenge, right? He's just repeating the same exact crimes.
That's right, yeah.
And so this is what made it so hard for me to the final act. I'm not saying that they wanted me to be on board with what the guy was doing, but it's just made it uncomfortable, and I couldn't even be on that. Well, how ironic that, you know, when we take revenge, we all suffer and we all lose our humanity and all that other stuff. That for me, you could justify to some degree the actions of Special Forces guy and I Saw the Devil, even though you recognize the toll it takes on his humanity. Here, the fact that he decides to go after the wife and daughter, that humanity's already gone.
Right.
Right? I mean, he's not going after Ilya. He's going after Ilya through innocent people.
That's right.
Well, and I Saw the Devil, he does the same thing, though.
Who does
he calls the guy's family, so they show up and pull the rope that chops his head off.
That's right.
Well, yep. Because that's a classic thing, though, even in the superhero movies, if you want to expand it, you know? They can't get at the superhero, so they go after who they love.
Right.
Because that's supposedly where everybody gets hurt.
But I like the point that Eric and Mike were saying, which is taking it out on innocence against the evil person for revenge. And the point is that, you know, in I Saw the Devil, yeah, the parents kill their own son, scumbag or not, when they shouldn't have been even involved in that because, you know, the son should have just been arrested and executed by the state or just, you know, this cell with cable TV. And
sent to bed without supper or something.
Yeah, exactly. And here, the same thing. And what happens instead is the innocents are
caught in the crossfire.
Are in the crossfire and become victims as well. And so the people who do the revenge against the quote-unquote evil person, they themselves have performed the exact same thing. But I do agree with Mike's point, which is it's probably worse in this film than in I Saw the Devil for the fact that the person that's doing the revenge is not setting up the bad guy to get killed by his parents, but is actually pointing guns at the family and forcing them to, you know, carry
panties. Here's the thing, though. I don't think – okay, and I Saw the Devil. That guy is absolutely 100% going to kill that motherfucker when he walks through that door. In Landmine Goes Click, I don't think Chris's ultimate intention was to kill the daughter. I don't think that's what he walked in wanting to accomplish.
I agree.
He walked in wanting to accomplish Ilya's confession in front of his wife and daughter, and he just didn't know when to stop.
Yeah, all right. That's fair. But the difference, though, is to get the confession, he was doing the same evil things that Ilya himself had done, in a sense.
Eye for an eye, motherfucker.
Right. Well, that's true. But as you've always said, Eric, you know, these revenge films, their parable is basically revenge doesn't pay. And
it's
in this case, it's the same way. Is he kills an innocent 18-year-old girl who has her whole life ahead of her, And
well, and also, absolutely, and that's why I like these movies, is because they do ultimately deliver that message.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But I so that, Mike, that's the thing, is that the reason you can't get on board 100% with this film, even if you do like the film, is because what Chris does is so heinous, especially when, in theory, even if he is a scumbag, even in the first act, you figure that the writer and director were trying to at least have us some way sympathize with the character, I guess. Is that what you're assuming, that they were trying to, and it obviously wasn't the case? Or were they just tricking us to sympathize with them, when in reality they wanted us to go, ha ha, you know, we pulled a fast one on you, he is a scumbag.
He comes across as a scumbag one way or another.
No doubt, no doubt. Yeah, I mean, well, that's the thing.
And this is why I want to be careful. I'm not sure what they were trying to do besides revenge bad.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And of course, if it's, you're not going to get that if the revenge is simply, you know, I don't know, he finds them and rapes them with a steel dildo or something. I don't know. That's going to get the point across, because we all know at this point Ilya is such a fucking asshole that we're going to be on and kind of on board with any revenge towards just him.
Yes, but then, just him. You're right. Yeah. Okay.
But then what that. It has him do is take is has Chris takes actions that are so
to heinous. Me
heinous or and
despicable.
And not the right target, because right. Again, you know. Yes, I saw the devil. He traumatized the guy's parents. He didn't kill them. He didn't torture them and murder them.
Yeah, that's
you know,
a fair
he didn't
point.
Rape his mother. He didn't do to them what the serial killer did to his family. You know, did to his fiance.
Right.
So, like I said, this is just where it lost me. And to me, it went too far in the second half with the revenge, and that might have been his point, and that's fine. It's just I didn't like where he decided to go with it. I don't know what I would have liked. I almost wished it had ended where it had. Before we ever got to that scene, or maybe if it had ended simply with them opening the door and us seeing him there and left it to our imagination. But making us go through that for another 25 minutes or so, after we'd already been through all this brutal shit in the first place. For me, it was just piling on more than I could handle at that point. And while I give him credit for doing everything well, or pretty much everything well up to throughout the film, I just didn't like the decisions, and it didn't work for me, and that's all I can say for it.
Fair enough.
Well, you know, there was one review that I read. I don't know if Philip read the same one, but there was a review that said that this would have worked really well as a short, and I could have seen it as a short, given the ending you suggested, Mike. Like I said, I felt the second half was like I was watching the same movie over again. It could have just been a little more, I hate to say, but creative, you know, torture them. Fine. Tie them up. Fine. Try to force Ilya's confession. Fine. But try to do it in a different way. Don't just copy the same crap. Cause
and really,
really
I
was watching the same movie twice.
Come on.
And I gotta be honest. I kind of like when you remember when we used to have porn in our torture porn? Come on. Can we get a little bit of the porn back? Is that too much to ask?
No, for sure. All right, then be back on serious.
This is a fucking depressing movie to talk about.
Well, that no,
right?
That's
obviously
that's fair, Mike. But yeah. Chrissy, I see your point.
No, it is. The whole eating panties thing just really scares me.
Now, Chrissy, I understand your point, which is, yeah, it's just the same thing over and over. But obviously, what the director and for the character Chris was trying to do was say, okay, Chris wants to do the exact same things to someone Ilya loves that Ilya did to someone he had loved. And it is repetitive in a sense. So I see your point. But I do see Eric's point too, which is if you're going to have a revenge film and revenge bad film, This was appropriate, I guess, even though I was horrified and depressed and shocked when the daughter was killed in the Russian roulette because of the disgustingness that Chris was, meaning, and I think that's the point of the film, right? The point of the film was to make us see Chris as nothing better than Ilya. Chris is Ilya. That's all he is. You know, even if you can argue that, say, oh, well, Chris probably would have never done this in the first place. Actions create reactions. But Chris was a scumbag right from the beginning of the film for different reasons.
And none
reasons.
Of it anyway. Ever would have happened if he hadn't banged his best friend's fiance.
Exactly.
And he would have gotten away with it, too, if not for those meddling kids.
I did love that line where Daniel said, the second you stepped on a landmine is the second you decided to fuck my girl.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah, that was, remember when he said that at the beginning?
Yeah, yeah.
You stepped on a landmine the second you decided to fuck my girl. That was really great.
And that is true.
I like that line.
And it's true, right? The moment he decided to fuck my girl.
I think everybody has anger issues.
It's like the thing about, you know, that famous quote by the Japanese admiral that says that we're going to, I'm really paraphrasing, I'm destroying it here, but he says we're waking up a sleeping giant when we attack America and we shouldn't. And they attack Pearl Harbor and guess what? You woke up a sleeping giant. And that's what Chris did the moment he had sex with his best friend's fiance. He woke up a sleeping giant, which is the same thing. You stepped on a landmine the moment you slept with my lover. That's wrath, wrath. And that's what happened.
And that's interesting you choose that analogy or that metaphor, just because if you wanted to think about how George has been run over by all the Russians and all these different countries over the years and fought over, that's just very interesting. All right, never mind. My head is going somewhere you guys don't even want to know. But yeah.
Metaphorically speaking,
that's a really interesting analogy. But yeah, go ahead.
No, and that's a fair point. I mean, there's a movie that Eric and Mike have not seen for various reasons, and that's a Serbian film. And a Serbian film, the director and screenwriters both claim that it's an allegory of how Serbia has been fucked over by the Greeks and the Turks and the Russians and the Germans and the Hungarians and on and on and on. This film, using similar horrendous violence and misogyny, you could even argue, does the same thing as an allegory to Georgia, which has been screwed over by the Greeks and the Persians and the Armenians and the Russians and the Turks, on and on. And that's the thing. A lot of these countries that have been screwed over for so many years, a lot of the art that comes from it is where they use that as an allegory for the violence that's in their films. And you could even go for this film as well. So that was an excellent point, Chrissy. I like that you brought that up. Any further thoughts people want to bring up? So that's pretty much the film. I mean, that's how it ends, and revenge bad, right, Eric?
I think we're done.
Yeah. So let's do our final thoughts. Do a roundtable, talk about our final thoughts, and hey, why don't you start?
I thought this was a pretty damn good film. I mean, it's definitely it's debatable where it would stand by the end of 2016, but overall, I was very pleased. It did have a few weak points there and some moments I think that could have been improved in some areas, but overall, it was an enjoyable, depressing film. I don't know if I would want to sit through it again, but it was still solid. I'm not sure if I would consider this one of my favorite revenge films, though. I mean, I think I saw The Devil one of the stronger forms of that genre. But I still suggest that people check out Landmine Goes Click. Who knows? Maybe you won't be disappointed.
There's a recommendation. Who knows? Maybe you won't be disappointed.
Well, and to be honest, to be fair, for Abe's comment there, it's because of the topic and what happens in the film. I mean, Mike.
I know. It just sounded really funny.
It did sound funny. So, Mike, why don't you go next? Because what Abe basically said is exactly what you've been saying from the beginning.
Right. I think we've all been guilty of saying it in the past, but it's one of the laziest and dumbest reviews anyone has ever said, which is that, well, this movie's not going to be for everybody. Well, that's true of literally every film ever made.
Right.
because everybody's a lot of people, and there's some schmuck out there who doesn't like Star Wars or The Godfather, right? But this is very close to the spirit of that, in which is that there are some movies that you don't like because they suck, and there's some movies you don't like because they're not for you. And for me, this just errs a little bit on the side of not for me, slightly. But I think it's well made enough. Look, I know this is a movie I can tell my mom don't watch, right? You know, it's there's and about 95% of the human race would not be interested in this film. But anybody who's into horror, who's into quote unquote torture porn, into revenge flick.
I object. I wouldn't call this movie torture porn.
That's why I said quote unquote. However you want to categorize it. I think give it a shot because, like I said, it went a shade too far for me. And that had more to do with how particular characters behaved and losing rooting interest for anybody in the movie than it had to do with how extreme and how far it went. Because as Eric pointed out, might have been on the last podcast or maybe it was the conversation afterwards, I like Martyrs, and that sure as hell went really extreme.
Right.
You know, but the difference being that I had a character I could sympathize with throughout the entire story.
Okay.
You know, and to me, that was the – and it's still – that was a movie I never would have watched a second time if not for having to do a podcast about. And also I would have said I would have had a really hard time recommending it to anybody without serious warning. Same kind of thing here. It's rapey. It's perverted. It's disturbing, more so than torture-y. And it's going to leave you unsettled. And it's certainly some people more unsettled than others. If you know that's the kind of thing you can handle, or worse yet, the kind of thing you're into, you might like it. Give it a shot.
For me, there's a lot of, as Abe said, a lot of great, great revenge films, or in the revenge, subgenre. And that would be like Old Boy, I Saw the Devil, Red, White, and Blue, Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance. So there's a lot of good ones, and I would consider all four of those fucking good ones. But this film, you could argue, is like a combination of that genre, but also the rape revenge genre, because again, the main thing that causes the final ending of the film was because of a rape, and so. I don't want to throw it in with the rape revenge films like Irreversible and I Spit on Your Grave and films like that. It has some of that element. So I think because of that, specifically, this film then falls into the category, as Mike said, which is it's a good film, but it's for a select audience, as we discussed about Martyrs, slightly in last week's episode, Mike, where we were discussing why would they remake Martyrs? Because it's for a select audience. So why would you want to try to think, oh, we can make more money off it by bringing it into the English language? So that would make this film similar to Martyrs or any of the rape revenge films, a selected audience. You know, even films like Taxi Driver, which are mainstream films, are considered selected audience films. So not everybody's going to like the film, but it is a well-made film. If you like thrillers, if you like horrors, if you like revenge films, if you like rape revenge films, if you're not disturbed with excessive violence in general, or implied in violence, then this film is most certainly worth watching if you're into thrillers or horror films. I actually thought it was a pretty good film. Definitely wouldn't show it to, you know, my wife or my parents. You know, it's not that type of film. But
you show it to your daughter.
Come on, Phil, where's your sense of adventure?
About to say that,
but they're 2 years old. They wouldn't understand anything.
Oh, that's even worse.
So I would recommend it for genre fans. Since me and Eric rated it pretty high as a 2015 horror film, it actually landed up as our 11th best horror film last year by Dark Discussion. So it's a good film, and one of our listeners, Michelle Barkley, watched it on our recommendation and actually said that she was glad that we had recommended it in our best of 2015 because it would have been a film that would have not been on her radar, and she was glad that she saw it. So recommend for sure.
And ever since, yeah, she's been inspired to bake a pair of panties into every cake she makes.
Oh, that is so gross. I was eating soup when I was watching this. Big mistake.
Eric. Final thoughts, sir.
Oh, I thought you were going to ask me a question. Yeah, this is a revenge movie. I don't think it's as good as the ones that Phil was listing off earlier. But I think it's decent. It is icky. It leaves you feeling icky. I think that's a sign of a good revenge movie. Mike doesn't care for it. So we disagree on that front. I can appreciate a movie that leaves me feeling icky if that's what it was supposed to do. I imagine that some people that listen to a podcast called Dark Discussions might like that kind of movie too. So if you're one of them, go check it out. And if you're not, don't. But I think it's a good revenge movie. And I recommend it for people who are into that kind of thing.
Yeah, very good. And Chrissy.
I agree. I think it's a great revenge film. I liked the suspense. I liked the ratcheting of the tension. While it's true that I think that some of the plot twists were sort of a little bit contrived and maybe a little too neat, I had a really good time. The only problem I had with this movie was that I felt that the second half was sort of a replay of the first and that it could have been done a little differently just to make it a little bit more interesting. And that maybe 5 minutes of the game playing could have been cut out of the front and the back end so that it just moved at a quicker pace. Other than that, if you like revenge, if you like suspense, I would say check it out. It's not a bad film. And I would certainly recommend it way over The Revenant if you're looking for revenge movies. So.
Yeah, there's another revenge film. Yeah, good point.
Yeah, but this one in my mind was like what a revenge movie should be. I was on the edge of my seat. Despite the flaws. So, and The Revenant, I was freaking looking at my watch going, when the hell is this going to end? So,
okay. All right. Well, fair enough. All right. So, that's 2015. Landmine Goes Click. Almost three films in one, in a sense. A lot of twists. Generally, everybody here thought the film was a good film. And number 11 on Dark Discussions, top 24 horror films of 2015, and it is on VOD, so it is available on pretty much everywhere. I mean, Chrissy saw it on Amazon. Me and Eric saw it on iTunes, where Abe and Mike saw it, probably one of those two things too. So it is available pretty much everywhere. Yet it has oddly had a very low profile, and hopefully. This podcast will help bring it to at least some folks' notice. So, with all that stated, Eric, why don't you leave this out?
All right. Thanks for tuning in and listening. Let's talk about Landmine Goes Click. Come back next week. We'll be talking about something more rural.
Click.
Rural. Now we got the chemistry, but we see.
Sadida guliyanat kadavigis kisay.